Senate will come to order. Messages from the House.
February the 24th, 2011, from the House of Representatives. Message number 402, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 33, State Park Acquisition of Lands. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 44, noes 14, excused 2. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting listed amendments. Message number 405, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 79, Recreation Safety Act waiver on behalf of minors. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 56, noes 2, excused 2. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Message number 406, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 85, Game and Fish Violations Penalties. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 47, noes 11, excused 2. House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Message number 410, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 144, State-Funded Construction Projects Preference Provisions. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 54, noes 4, excused 2. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
You don't want these back.
Joint Conference appointment. Senator Coe, in regard to House Bill 127, School Finance Recalibration, that conference committee will be Coe, Von Flatern, and Meyer. We do have a number of concurrences, but I think we'll wait on those until later. And with that, I think we'll go ahead and move on to the consideration of bills on general file. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself back into Committee of the Whole.
Heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Senator Emmerich, would you like to come back to the chair, please? Before Senator Emmerich, I'm going to recognize Senator Case there.
Thank you. Mr. President, thank you very much. Privilege of the floor.
Go ahead.
Mr. President, can I ask if a conference committee has been established on House Bill 74? I don't believe that there's been a meeting noticed, and I've heard that there is going to be a meeting subsequent to today, and I'd like to know if that is true.
I think Senator Hicks, would you like to respond to that conference committee?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we did have a meeting this morning, but some more information had come to light, and we postponed that conference meeting until 4:15 today or upon adjournment in S1.
Okay. That satisfy? Okay. With that, go ahead, Senator Von Flatern.
Mr. President, according to the rules, we're supposed to announce when we have conference committee meetings. If they had it already and it wasn't announced publicly, I think that violates one of our rules.
So noted. I think that we can all use that as a caution in regard to the announcement of conference committees. I do understand that things get moving pretty rapidly at the end, but your comment's well taken, Senator Von Flatern. With that, we've already acted upon the motion to resolve ourselves back in the committee of the whole, and I'd ask then for Senator Emmerich to come to the chair.
Committee of the Whole, please come to order. The first bill this afternoon, House Bill 120.
House Bill 120, Public Meetings, an Act Relating to Public Meetings, sponsored by Representative Edmonds. It was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, Cultural Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Christensen, Dockstader, Driscoll, and Escobel. No, Senator Burns. Senator Burns, Chairman.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think the reading clerk is done yet. There's a standing committee amendment.
You want to
stand? Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 120. There is a standing committee amendment, and I ask that it be read in now.
House Bill 120, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 2, line 21.
Mr. Chairman, I ask that you call on the good senator from the 4th Estate.
Senator Dockstader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate, if I could put this up, if I still have the mic.
I think it stayed on this
Thank
time.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate, I'd like to open this up with just stating that information is the fuel of democracy. Self-governance has little meaning if you don't know what's going on around you. If you'd indulge me to bring James Madison into this discussion, he said, "A popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce or a tragedy, or perhaps both. Knowledge will forever govern ignorance, and the people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with power which knowledge gives." Now, House Bill 120 that we're taking up now does not change either the open or closed part of our public meetings, but it attempts to ensure that the public has access to information that should be open to them. House Bill 120 does not change when the public bodies may go into an executive session, but it helps to ensure that the public may hear discussions that the current law says should be open. And I'm going to go over the bill, but I'd like to refer you to a handout in your desk, House HB 121, Reasonable Access to Public Records. You're going to find a lot of answers to your inquiries right there. It's a good summary of what we're addressing here with 121. Excuse me, 120. 120, Ensuring Public Access to Meetings. We've got these two bills back to back. I'm just trying to track them here for you. And going through the bill, 120, of course, in the opening, it's a notice for special meetings, audio recordings of executive sessions, and review of executive sessions. I'm going to take you down to B, the bottom of the page. This is the 12-hour notice, giving notice of the meeting. At least 12 hours, and then putting it out to newspapers of general circulation, radio, television stations, and submit to the body that many of these already have their websites up and running, and they're the go-to source for public information. So if a public meeting gets changed, people will generally find out right there on those websites or with those media sources that are associated with those websites. Notice shall specify the time and place of the special meeting, and then taking you down to B, this calls for the recording of the session, the audio recordings. That's the new part in here. And this allows the let me explain why we're approaching this. We've already got the minutes that are required of our public meetings. Minutes, recordings, and proceedings of executive sessions will remain confidential. But this allows the public to access the government pending a court review. So those recordings that we're inserting into this public setting right now, this allows for the court to first review it before, if someone requires it and asks for something that went on in regards to public session, it first goes before the court and a judge. And if I could, this ties in with this amendment. If I could, we move the amendment now, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator.
Okay. And then explain to you where it's inserted. On page 2, line 21, let me just back up just a little bit into that sentence. The beginning of the sentence, a person may seek access to the minutes or recordings of an executive session by filing a petition with the district court wherein the record is found for an order directing the custodian of the record and then inserting the amendment, the governing body or both, to show cause why he should not permit the inspection of the minutes or the recording. We felt like that clarified the language a little better in committee. What this does, and if I can take you over to page 3 and continuing with those lines 1 through 6, if something was discussed that the court determines to be public record, it can be released, but it has to go through the court first. It has to go through the judge. That's the screening device here. And then in C, lines 13 through 19, an executive session can be held after the announcement. Just can't move it into the executive session without making some type of announcement as to what the executive session is doing. And then in D, lines at the bottom of the page, lines 21 through 23, please note in a court review that the attorney-client privilege still prevails. And that was something that the House felt pretty strong about. And so that amendment came there that the on page 4, that amendment was added. They wanted to have that attorney-client privilege in there for further protection, and so the tape recorder can be turned off under those circumstances. I'm going to take you back to a little summary now as you look over your handout there on 120, ensuring public access to meetings. Talk about the recording of these executive sessions. Members of the body, several counties are currently requiring their boards to record executive sessions. Testimony has been given that the recording has been beneficial. It provides an indisputable record that a governing body was perhaps failing the law. It has encouraged members to remember that they must maintain decorum as the people's representatives, whether they meet in open or closed session. Members may be disposed about executive sessions and litigation. Federal court and state court have followed the majority rule and found that members may be questioned about executive sessions. A willful and knowing violation of the Public Meetings Act is a misdemeanor. However, a member may stay in an executive session that he believes may be illegal without exposing himself to a criminal charge if he states an objection. And guess where that helps him? There's a recording to say, I object to this executive session. There's the protection. And then talking about the reason for the executive session and stating it. Again, this is aimed at helping us to avoid issues. If a member of the public or the governing board knows the reason for the executive session, they can object if they believe it's not appropriate. However, this will avoid problems by preventing illegal executive sessions from happening in the first place. Members of the body, I understand your concerns here, but I think in summary, what we're doing and what I've heard in testimony and those who are already working with recorded executive sessions, this protects not only the public, it puts what should be in the public's hands. It's screened by the court first, it's screened by the judge, allows the public to have access to it under proper scrutiny, and it'll protect those who are serving on the public bodies. I have some experience serving on a public body, on a council, and prior to this, on a town council, my wife served on a school board, and there were times when we said, this one probably isn't for executive session. I would have welcomed a recording session there to hear my statement say, I don't think this should be taken into executive session. I ask for your favorable approval of 120.
Senator Coe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just a couple of questions, and I'm not sure how I feel about this bill, but seems to me that we passed legislation here a couple of years ago that requires, if you are in executive session, you have to take minutes anyway. Am I right?
Ah. Senator Meyer.
Are the recordings held? Do they have to be archived? I'm just kind of curious as to the answer to that particular question.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I was a no vote in committee on this, and I wanted to explain why. First of all, I was the only no vote on this in committee. I was rewarded by an editorial in my local paper suggesting right at the end that I am up for re-election in 2014. So I understand that a lot of people here will not want to vote against their local newspapers who are really pushing this. One of the things mentioned in that editorial was the fact that the Wyoming Press Association has worked on this for the last year. This and the next bill, 121, are their two highest priorities. The concern I have, given that statement, is the fact I never heard of this bill until after the session had started. And I don't know why there wasn't anything in my local paper about it. There was nothing in our local press about it. So there was no discussion about it. I consider that to be important because at first flash, when you read this bill, you're thinking, okay, yeah, that might make some sense for county commissioners and for our city to handle. But this goes to all governmental bodies. We have 99 municipalities in this state, 23 counties. I don't know how many commissions and boards branch off of those. Those are all governmental bodies. Those are all covered by the requirements of this. There are over 400 districts. Fire districts, irrigation districts, hospital districts, they're all covered by this. One of the problems I have on this is who's going to volunteer? These are all voluntary boards. Who's going to volunteer to be the secretary under this requirement? And that goes on to the question of the good senator from Goshen County about how long are these tapes to be kept? Some other questions, I think, that we have to think about on this bill. There's no penalty provision. What happens if you don't meet the 12-hour deadline? What happens if you don't keep the tape recording? And in answer to the good senator from Cody, yes. There is current law that says you have to keep minutes. This would alter that. You'd have to make audio recordings. And then the other concern that hit me was on page 2, that these audio recordings, the petitioner, which in most cases, face it, will probably be some news organization or newspaper, they can go to the court and ask to hear these. But there's no reason to show cause. Why? Your Honor, we want to see this recording. We want to hear this recording. And it's up to the judge. But why do they want to hear it? What criteria is the judge going to use to decide if those executive session tapes are going to become public or not? That's not listed in this bill. Mr. Chairman, I don't want to take long because I know we only have 2 days for a general file. Those are a number of my concerns on this bill. And I think that it's a good topic, and I agree with the aim on this. But I think this is something that should be done in an interim study by a committee. One of the judiciary is considering this as an interim topic, and I would ask that you resist this bill so that we can look at this more strongly. Thank you. Except for more strongly.
Senator Bebout, you're first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a question for the sponsor, and we're trying to see the practicality of this, and I put myself in the position if I were to be a school board member, a solid waste district, a fire district, or whatever, and I went into executive session, and it could be for a lot of things, but ultimately it might have to do with litigation. So I am a board member, and I'm in there, and I'm a volunteer, and I'm trying to deal with a sensitive issue, and I know that whatever I say probably will be litigated, so do I then, in this meeting, executive session, do I have to have counsel?
As we talk about issues, do I have to protect myself for things that I may say or may not say if this thing goes to court? I just think you're taking away from the volunteer nature of what we do on these boards and commissions, and I just worry about that. So maybe the sponsor of this bill can explain to me a little bit about the thinking about it from that perspective and how they will relate and what it does to this volunteer process we have in Wyoming.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, too, speak against this bill and a lot with our fellow senator from Sheridan back there. To answer his question, what if you don't record it? Well, according to this bill, I guess you just get another nasty editorial about how rotten you are for not following through on this. Let's wipe the dust off this and look at it. Well, this is film at 11 and front page selling newspapers. This is all it is. We put this open meetings requirements on all of our boards and our commissioners and everything last couple of years, and some of these guys couldn't even ride in a car together to go to a meeting because it might be a quorum and stuff like that. This is over the line. The system that we have isn't broken. You can take notes. I would hope that you would defeat this bill.
Amendment on the
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, on the amendment, no problems with the amendment.
Okay, call for the question. All those in favor of Senator Dockstetter's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 120, please say aye. Those no? Amendment is passed. Back on the bill. Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, we all love our newspapers, and they're a valuable part of everything we do, but the language that you see that's in the that's not been changed is language that went through an interim study and was very deliberate. And there are a couple things that I wanted to point out and to have some discussion about. First of all, we exempted ourselves as the legislature from this, and part of the reason is most of you guys have one of these computers here. And the issue was, should our emails be available for everybody in the world to see? And part of the reason why we concluded that we should not make those emails available is because our constituents, when they write to you, and I'm not talking about the bulk ones that write to everybody on House Bill, whatever, but there are some where you get colleagues or friends of yours who want to give you very special confidential information with an expectation that it would be held private. And part of the performance of our jobs is receiving that information. And it was our conclusion that if you provided all your emails pretty soon you wouldn't get a lot of that information that you really need to get. Now, if you turn to page 2 of the bill, and specifically looking at lines 16 through 18, when we last visited this issue after interim study, we said that the proceedings of executive session shall be confidential and produced only in response to a valid court order. And so to the extent that there were written notes, we wanted to make sure that they were there. We knew that the court would see it, and that suppose it's a hospital board, I've served on a hospital board, and you have a nursing staff give you complaints about the CEO or something that's would be embarrassing for them for anybody to know, they wouldn't want to do it. And you're in executive session talking about something that's appropriately there, and you disclose that information. Now you've disclosed information that's very confidential that was given to you to make a decision, and you want to have that decision to make good decisions during your executive session. Well, now, if you look at lines 18 through 21 and 22, there's a process, and obviously this is designed by somebody that wants to get that information, but the process is that I, as a person, go and said, I want those tapes. And somebody has to show cause why they shouldn't be delivered. Now, I'm a member of the board. How am I even going to get notification of this? Suppose I'm a member. Who's the notice to go to? I assume it's going to go to the chairman of the board or maybe even the council. Maybe even to the CEO of the hospital. And as a member, I don't even know that those minutes just got requested. And whoever got notice now has the burden to go show why they shouldn't be produced. Now, if I said something that was confidential, I want to be the one defending my confidentiality. But the flip side of it is if I'm going to volunteer for a board, I don't want to have to go down to the court every time somebody, every week that the newspaper wants to see what was discussed. And let's take it, we have a situation with our hospital where about every 2 or 3 years we get relationships that are very complex. Now there's part of me that says there's no harm in having these things recorded. That in itself isn't a bad idea because maybe it will require more congeniality and more professionalism inside the executive sessions. Bad language will go down, things like that. Having said that, if you're a member of the board and you don't like the CEO and you said some things that you would find embarrassing but is really pointed and needs to be said in an executive session about information, this request goes to the CEO, and the CEO, do you think that CEO is going to care about what you said? And if you disclosed information that was provided to you privately, do you think the CEO is going to care one iota? In fact, the CEO may say, here's the tapes and go report them, folks. Report them because I kind of want, you know, I want that person to be embarrassed. So now you're going to get back to the issue is what is the, you know, there's a purpose to have open and frank discussions. And oftentimes to talk about things that you find embarrassing or that were disclosed to you in confidence in order to make sure these institutions are run fairly. Now, if we had this gone through in our study and we decided, yes, one, we ought to have a recording, I suspect we would have, as a group, said, if it's recorded, then the presumption is that these are confidential. And if you want to go through a process to get this information, you've got to go to court. You've got to demonstrate there's some basis to get it. We're going to give notification to all the members of those boards so they can know that their statements are going to be disclosed. And the court is going to go through and give limited information. And, in fact, the court might not even let you hear the recorded transcript. We might distill it to a written transcript. There's a variety of things that we would do to protect and encourage people, good people, to serve on these boards. And none of that protection exists. So we've essentially eliminated all the protection in 17 through 18 that was well discussed over an entire interim session and resulted in making sure that these things were protected, they wouldn't be disclosed, and if you were a member, you knew they weren't going to be disclosed. And now it's you go there and you have no idea who's going to disclose those tapes or not. I submit to you, if you're a member on the board in it and you're not the chairman, you will not even know that those transcripts or the recording have been produced. And the first thing you're going to see it is when you open up the newspaper and they're trying to embarrass you. And it seems to me that good people that are serving on these, we ought to give them some level of protection that they won't be embarrassed on the morning after for doing what they thought was a tough job. So I would urge some very caution in terms of protecting people. This shifts the burden away from that, says you're not protected, and there again, having the transcripts themselves may be a good thing, but they ought to be protected.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, if I could share with you, the last 6 years before coming down here, I was on a board, and I've been on a number of different boards where we did this. And I don't look at this as on behalf of the media wanting it. I look at it as this is some great insurance for the members of that board to have an accurate record of what took place. Now, I do believe it As was stated earlier, it does put us on our better behavior to know that every word's being recorded. But when you don't have those words being recorded, and when the issue gets tough enough, if your minutes are an outline form, if they're not an exact quote verbatim, it leaves you exposed. And people doubt what's written, they doubt what's recorded. They can still get access, but you don't have that protection. And after being involved in these and having executive sessions, everything recorded, I think it's really to the protection of the people who are in the meeting and those board members. This is just the kind of thing that I think really does benefit folks. I recently sat through a number of painful meetings when people tried to remember what was said 4 years earlier. And what they found in the written minutes was a very brief reference to a consultant making a recommendation, but nobody said exactly what happened. As it was, the community, the government, and the citizens were on the hook for probably $500,000 that, with an accurate record, I suspect would have reversed that role. These recordings are not, and today especially, are not difficult to capture. It's generally digital. The storage isn't a problem. The length of the record is kept is already defined, and our clerks have to live with that. As far as our boards that are appointed in the county and city levels, I think they need that protection too. Now, they need to be educated on what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. But an ignorance of the law isn't a good excuse. And so that education that goes along with that responsibility when citizens step up, I think, answers a lot of these concerns. The language in question on the bottom of page 2 and page 3, let's give this an opportunity to move forward and be modified. I appreciate the questions that are being raised, but just from a protection from both the people who are appointed to the board and the community, if we're doing something wrong in executive sessions, let's not write an outline form of the minutes. Let's make sure we're doing the right thing for the community. And I think it inspires confidence and strengthens the whole process and strengthens our faith in government. So I'd encourage us to move this forward and allow it to be come under the scrutiny of amendments and further discussion.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I think there are some good points made on the bill here, especially on the burden. That's an easy fix. And I happen to agree that that may be a deficiency in the bill at this point in time. However, let's not fool ourselves to think that there isn't any problems. And I can tell you that in communities that I know about is that boards will go into executive session, and when they come out of it, there'll be a series of motions, not dealing with things that you would normally associate with executive sessions, things like your employees or different contracts or different things. And there'll be a series of motions without any discussion, and the votes are already tallied, and the minute lasts probably 10% of what the time of what the executive session lasts. And so that's what we're trying to get to. We're trying to get to those areas where the meetings, the true meeting, is held in executive session, and when the people come out of executive sessions, all you have is motions to approve or motions to disapprove, and it's right out the door, and the meeting's closed. Now, this is what's going on. And I do agree with the good senator from Sheridan County that maybe we're casting the net too wide. And I think we can come up with an exemption for special districts, and we can see how it works and let this thing play out. But let's not throw this bill away on committee of the whole. Let's get together, address our concerns, and try to make this something that will actually work. Because folks in some places, and these are places that affect every one of us in our day-to-day lives, the system is not quite working the way it's supposed to.
Senator Bebop.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can understand from listening to the debate why a certain element of our society wants these to be recorded. I can't understand how, as a board member, this is going to help me be a better board member. I just don't see it. I think it takes away from my ability to do what I want to do as a board member, and as my colleague from Albany County states, to you know, pick up and read about something that's misinterpreted based on their interpretation of a tape that may come up, you know, 6 months later, and now I read about it a lot quicker. I think that detracts from my ability to be a board member, and we're talking about and the exemption side, where does it begin and end? Is it if you're elected to a city council, okay, then it is recorded, but if you're appointed to the solid waste district, it's not? There's 400 of them. Where do you draw the line? I just think that you know, Wyoming is, I haven't seen a problem in this, other than the perception out there. It works well, and everything I've been around in my county, my city, I just don't think we need this.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, maybe there are some problems with this system of executive sessions, but I'm not sure that this is the solution to those problems. You know, a number of years ago, I dealt with a lot of classified material, which is certainly at a different level than what we're talking about here. But the reality is it's analogous, and one of the things I learned in handling that is that the reason the material is classified isn't always because of the content of the material. It's the source of that material that is being held close. And that's an important distinction that I really didn't realize until I was holding it a lot. And the reason for that distinction and the reason we have executive sessions is to a large degree along those same lines, so that people can be candid, so that people can bring in where they heard things, bring in the sources, without necessarily having that go on public record. It's to allow for that possibility of trust so that you can bring in information that you wouldn't otherwise get. And if you can't keep that information private, if you can't keep it secret, then you're not going to get that information. And that's certainly what we find as the federal government, which is why I was handling the classified material. And we see a short time ago that we had a little bit of a snafu on that, and a lot of that material was leaked. You know, that was a lot of embarrassment as a result of that. But there's a reason to keep secrets under certain circumstances. Now, I think we can probably all agree, Mr. Chairman, that that gets abused. And I don't think anyone in here wants that to be abused. And I think we're all working together to find solutions that minimize that abuse while still protecting the valid aspects of it or the valued aspects of keeping that. Some of the other problems I have along those lines, once again, is just the concept of training and handling of this material. If we generate material that is confidential and effectively our version of classified, again, I had extensive training in handling that, and we still screw up. Not only that, but we had special storage locations. We had handlers. We had people whose job it was to make sure that people could not get that information. And now we're saying, as the good senator from Fremont County pointed out, we've got a volunteer force of people who are trying to cooperate to make things better, who now also have to be competent at handling information that is supposed to remain private. That's really hard. This is a non-trivial thing, and we're putting that onus on them. I don't think I would want to do that as my volunteer position. You know, I don't want to join the city council and then have to maintain that privacy and have a vault in my living room or something that I'm supposed to protect from people getting to it. You know, the intent here is so good, but the reality of it is so difficult that I just do not think this is a viable bill. The only part in it really that I see, Mr. Chairman, that's workable is the 12-hour notice. I'm certainly willing to stand behind the 12-hour notice, but beyond that, I don't see a lot in here that we can really get behind, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we should throw this bill out right now. I think it's a bad bill. And it's, you know, all the years I've been down here, I have heard from nobody that this is a problem. The saying used to be with the good predecessor of the good senator from Fremont County, never argue with anybody that buys ink by the barrel. And that's probably true, but I can tell you I have not heard from my constituents, other than the media people, that this is a problem. In my way of thinking, this is a solution looking for a problem. You'll ruin the volunteer efforts of local boards. A lot of times up on the school board, up where I live, they can't hardly find enough people to run. They can't find enough people to run for hospital boards. If you pass this bill, you'll ruin that effort you'll ruin that voluntary effort that takes place locally. I think it's a good time to throw it out.
Senator Jennings. Mr. Chairman, I think this is our attempt to be big government back down to the counties and the districts. If a county feels that they, or a board feels that they want to record something, archive it, keep it for future, let them do it. There's a board in my town or my county that does it. And there wasn't any particular security put on it. Don't even know if they wanted security on it, but an interesting thing happened. Right before election time, a snippet of one of those recordings came out, and it was on every radio station and quoted in the newspapers about this terrible thing that one of the board members said. Again, this is top of the fold. You know, film it, film on the 10 o'clock news. Let's throw it out.
Senator Von Flader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really wasn't going to stand up, but I think we're seeing a lot of things that go bump in the night on this. We already have written records. It's just going to be audio. And I know, let's say my county is the poster child for executive sessions that have gone awry. And I can tell you that we would like to know what they really did do in there. And I think it would have gotten to a judge at some point on this one particular group. And before that, it was the hospital group. So it's already written. I don't know what recording will have to do with it. How much that changes it. I think it's a good idea. I think the exact verbiage, what I said in the meeting, I'm happier to have that come out than the interpretation of the person that wrote down some sketch of what I said or how they wanted to write it down. It's truly recorded. Hey, I don't have an argument with it, and they can still get this information today. All we're saying is let's put it on a recording so the exact words are heard.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, again, I've seen boards marginalized based on doubt and people accusing them of doing things in executive session that I don't know if they did or didn't do. But because there wasn't that tight record, the public good was significantly damaged. And so when I look at this, again, please, I'm not fighting for the media. I'm fighting for the people on those boards and that opportunity to have accurate records of what takes place. So they have a defense. It's been my experience that depending on who the makeup of the board is, what happens in an executive session may last. That confidentiality may make it 5 minutes, it may make it 20 hours, but I've had people tell me within the day what happened in our executive sessions or what they were told happened in them. And this is a tool to really help protect and defend the people that are doing the business of the community. Going to the part that we have, you know, well-meaning citizens that don't understand it, that doesn't excuse them from the already existing laws and the constraints and penalties of those laws. This is important. When you go into an executive session, it's a very narrow focused conversation. And if you have the luxury of having an attorney in there with you to say you're on track or you're off track, that's a great thing. But either way, you're still bound by our existing laws, the people's laws. And so please don't be scared of a recording when I really do think that the majority of the time it is to your favor. And when it's not, maybe you were saying or off track. But when you're doing the business of the community, I think it's important to have a record. And just in the last thing I'd like to say on this, unless the laws have changed recently, just because you don't think there's a recording doesn't mean there isn't one. I can record our conversations. I think the law allows for only one person in a conversation to know what's being recorded, and everybody can be recorded. And so you need to, just because you don't see a recorder on the table, please know that it doesn't mean you're not being recorded.
Senator Dockstetter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the discussion on this. Appreciate your concerns. Address here those that I've noted. Mind you that the Public Records Act now requires a custodian to show just cause why to produce that record. As far as the archive question, how long, I can get that answered before another reading for you. Submit to you that, yes, there are a lot of boards and committees out there with a lot of great volunteers. I've worked with them for three decades in my publication. And when it comes right down to it, we're dedicating and spending and doing a lot with money down here in Cheyenne and sending it out to these districts and these boards. Aren't these people working with the public funds? Shouldn't we have full disclosure of what's happening with them? As far as that concern goes, the judge can listen to the tape in private to determine if that discussion fell within legal exemptions to the public meetings laws. I submit to you that it's all about keeping the public's business open to the public. For those of you who have been offended by your local media, I'm sorry. We're talking about something different here. We're talking about the public's right to know. And that's what it comes down to. Just a few minutes ago, we were concerned. Did a conference committee get properly put out there for the public to know? We brought that up. Did the public have full knowledge that we were going to meet in conference and talk about a matter? Now, this is the same concept. We're talking about the people's right to know, and that's what it comes down to. I ask for your favorable consideration of this bill.
Questions been called for? All of those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 120. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The chair is in doubt. Those in favor, please stand. House Bill 120 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Senator Hicks.
Chairman.
You bet, now that your mic's on.
Mr. Chairman and members in the committee, I would hope that you could help me welcome the Rollins High School government classes on the balcony that have come over to witness the way we do business in Wyoming. If you'd help me, give him a hand, please.
The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 121.
House Bill 121, Public Records, an Act Relating to Public Records, sponsored by Representative Edmonds. It was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, Cultural Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Christensen, Doc Statter, and Escobel. No, Senators Burns and Driscoll. Senator Burns, Chairman.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 121. There are no standing committee amendments. And for a further explanation of the bill, I ask that you call on Citizen Dockstetter.
Senator Dockstetter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for filling an interesting role today. For more than 100 years, members of the Senate, it's been the policy of this state that the public's records may be examined free of charge. The legislature, as early as 1910, passed this statute. All books and papers required to be kept in county offices are open to the examination of any person without fee. This time I refer you to your handout, HB 121, Reasonable Access to Public Records, while I go over the highlights of the bill. The title calls for reasonable time to reproduce a public record and clarifies what would be a reasonable fee for duplication. And then on page 2 in I, it addresses a reasonable cost. And in E, sets the time period for accessing those public records, not less than 3 days, not to exceed 7 days, with the agreement, as we proceed down the page on line 20, the agreement that's done by both parties, the request is not large or voluminous. That's on line 22. And, of course, on the next page, line 3, fulfilling the request would not impair the agency's ability to discharge its duties, or would impair them, so that it wouldn't get in the way of getting their job done. Then on line 4F, government worker will explain why a request can't be taken care of at the time. If there's a problem, they say why, and then they work out a time frame that they can get it taken care of. Continuing with the changes, down at the bottom of 3, there's no charge for retrieval of the information, reasonable cost for the duplication. In other words, if they have to spend a lot of labor, that's not the charge. There is a charge for duplication if they have to make copies and so forth. And specifying on the final page 4, cost for labor may be charged only when the request requires the custodian to compile data or extract data or redact information in order to create a new document to comply with a public record request. Members of the body, again, this bill does not change what is open or closed, but it helps ensure what we have access to, which is already open. The Public Records Act refers to custodians, which is defined as a caretaker. Government officials are the caretakers of the public records. This legislation makes it clear that anything that a custodian must do to make a record available for inspection by a citizen cannot be charged for. A citizen wants to take a copy home, then he must pay for the cost of duplication of that record. A citizen that wants information compiled into a new record must pay for the cost of doing so. The bill does not change that. This was put into effect several years ago so the state agencies could provide compiled reports from electronic databases for private companies where it is seen as beneficial to help the people of the state of Wyoming. This legislation also sets a time period in which custodians must respond to the public records request. They must provide the records within 7 days, or if they have good reason, they can notify the citizen requesting the record the reason why it will take longer. So in summary, custodians must respond in 7 days, either providing the records or the reasons why it will take longer. This prevents custodian from simply ignoring a request. I would remind you of the request by our governors to the Bureau of Land Management recently that has gone unanswered for several months. This just puts it in a reasonable time frame and keeps the records open and accessible. Ask for your favorable consideration.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, a question. I'm having some problems on page 3, if maybe we can get some clarification there. If you go to page 3 and then line 19 and 20, it reads the custodian shall not charge for the retrieval of an existing record regardless of the format. Well, what would be a record that's non-existing? And the way I read this is we've got conflicting language. One point it says you can charge for a record, but then you shall not charge for an existing record. So what records can they actually charge for in this bill? Because it looks to me like, based on the verbiage here, that you could only charge for a non-existing record.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There was a little bit of a study on this bill over the interim. And it involved some folks out of the media and about 5 agencies. One of them included my community college. And they did a test run. I guess it's all right. You can go push them and see what you can get out of them. But that test run collecting information that they didn't use for anything other than probably to write this thing up, took a couple lawyers, so they had about $3,000 with in lawyer fees, took the president, because they were wanting all of his communication, took him out of circulation for a day so that he could go back, and then he went through to see which was personnel and which was things would fall in there, and then the lawyers had to come back in there. And that was before there was this kind of day restriction on it. But one of the things that he brought up was, what happens when the guy whose records you're looking for is out of town? Our president travels. He goes to, comes down here. He goes to other states. He works on the college's business. And if that request is made the day that he's on the airplane going someplace, how does he comply? Is there somebody left there? Do you have to make sure you leave somebody back at your home office or your facility to make sure that they can comply? So I think that that's something that's not taken into consideration here, and that maybe the system we have isn't really that broken.
Senator Dockstetter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In answer to the inquiries, I read it as existing records, but we can clarify that on another reading if that would help. To those in the office, I think those records are accessible. There's enough communications. I submit to you there's enough communications in this world that we could track down the records we needed in a proper time frame. And I think that I pointed that out to you, that we have that in there, that you can have an agreement by both parties there. Members of the body, I realize public service can be difficult. You're on the tail end of probably some of the most difficult public service in this state. It's very intense. But again, we must keep in mind that we're about doing the public's business, whether it's here in Cheyenne or across the state of Wyoming. Government belongs to the people. Government officials are simply managers. That business we call government. Just as the owners of a business have the right to know what their managers are doing, I think I've heard each of you make the phone calls and check in with your businesses at home to make sure they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. Just as the owners of the business have the right to know what their managers are doing on their behalf, so do the people of Wyoming when it comes to their government. I ask for your favorable consideration.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we go through this this bill and work it the next couple of days, we need to recognize one thing. I've been engaged on both sides of this thing in my career, and recently we did a request that took about 2.5 months for the to collect the data. And here's the fiction that exists in here. The fiction is that there is a single custodian of record that houses all the records that exist in a governmental entity. And the fiction is that if I want, for example, to get records from that involve an activity of the city council, planning or zoning, the fiction is that as I deliver to the clerk a request for records, that the clerk has everything there and she pushes a button and says, here's the file. The reality of it is, in this, for example, instance, it dealt with planning and zoning issues. There are emails going between city council people, city staff. There were emails going between people that would circulate around. There were records in one department, records in another department. Now, I'm not required to send my request for documentation for my FOIA request to every entity. I just take it down to the county clerk or to the city clerk. I want everything. And you begin a process then of working with the city attorney to figure out what's out there. And then you collect all this information and you're saying, hey, I got an email here that shows that Joe Blow and three other people received these records. Where are they? And they say, well, geez, you know, we didn't go through to read to see who are all the recipients of it. We just try to gather everything, but we'll go out and get it. When you get email, I mean, I don't know how many of you are adept enough of going through all your emails and searching for the last 30 days all your emails and which ones you've got and which ones relate to a particular topic. But that, folks, that's not an easy task. It might be, and it's even difficult for the IT. So your IT person may be going from computer to computer to computer. Now you got a situation where it's a city councilman and he's using his home computer, and in some instances you're going to have the IT person go to the city councilman's because he had no idea how to get that stuff out of his computer. And so it is true that if you are sending a request for a single document, that's a hard document that's not electronic, 3 days isn't, you know, 7 days is not a bad time to expect a response. But if you send a generic request out there that gets into the electronic world or is a the result of a collective action of 15 or 20 people, you're not going to have it in that amount of time. Now, you say, well, that's what these safeguards are, and that is the if it's agreed to by the parties. Well, if I'm trying to push people around, I'm not going to agree to it. The request is voluminous. Well, the request wasn't voluminous. It just says, give me everything you've got on this. It's the response. And then fulfilling the request would impair the agency's ability to discharge its duties. Well, I submit to you, if the city of Laramie wouldn't have, they could have, the street still would have been open if everybody would have stopped that day and collected all my information. But if you're going to have one information officer go around and collect it, it's going to take you a lot of time. I agree there should be a prompt attentiveness, but this is a tight time schedule for anything except for a request for a singular document. So we need to think about that.
Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, very briefly, I just don't understand where this bill's coming from. For the life of me, I can't remember one incident with any of my constituents where this is a problem. I haven't been lobbied on this at all. Never heard about this bill till about a week ago. I don't understand where the problem is. I think it's a bad bill as well. I think we ought to do what we almost did with the last bill.
Senator Landon.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have, just like the rest of you, sat through the conversations on the previous bill and then this one, And you know, I have to lean in the direction of a good friend of mine from up in the Northwest. I keep going back to my journalism school days. I'm a journalism graduate. I used to be a newspaper journalist, and boy, I'm reaching all the way back to that, trying to get my arms around these. And I just keep thinking, you know, man, I really would have loved to have had a tape recording and not had to chase sources. I would have loved this too, you know. But here's the heartburn that I'm having with this one. It kind of goes to what the senator from Albany County was talking about, folks, and that is, you know, think about a private business versus a public business. The public business really isn't any different than a private business. And if you try to gather up everything that a media outlet wants at the snap of a finger, and believe me, 7 days is the snap of a finger, this is pretty onerous, and it's pretty difficult to do. And frankly, a whole bunch of the information that this gathers up, you know, we're going to get a bunch of dolphins with the tuna here. And I'm just not sure that that's proper or right, you know, to throw a great big net over everything, gather it all in. And I, like I said, you know, part of the journalist in me says, you know, boy, that might be pretty good because we might gather up something that generates a different headline. This one's a tough one. I the time frame concerns me.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, I would have to concur with my colleague to the right here. This thing does start to smell a little fishy.
Senator Bernard.
neither one of these bills, 121 or 20, has any kind of a fiscal impact on it. And I just wonder how many millions of dollars we're going to be spending in our governments to meet these requirements. We're come here to save people money, not cost them millions of dollars for perhaps no reason. So I'd like to see some physical impact on these sometime.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I was a no on this also in committee. And some of the concerns mimic some of the same concerns from the last bill. Again, keep in mind, this deals with every political subdivision in the state, 400 districts. If you've got an irrigation district and you basically got a farmer who's the secretary of your district, and he was not the secretary the year before, and I don't know why, if this bill passes, why anybody would want to be the secretary on it, who's responsible for these records? Who's responsible for the transfer of these records? Then the other concern I have, again, that was reflected in the last bill, what's the penalty? If you don't get the record to them, when, what happens? You get a bad editorial? There's no penalty in here. And then on the conditions, the mitigating conditions, such as the request is voluminous or it would impair the agency's ability to discharge its duties, who determines that? By whose judgment? By the newspaper's judgment or by the agency's judgment? Mr. Chairman, we had testimony in committee from a nice young lady who came. She works for the Department of Health. And she gets these requests. She got a request for over 1,000 files. And under this, they would have 3 days to do that. You think that's going to impair that office? Yeah, I think it is. Even federal, even for federal requests, it's 20 days. I think 3 days is virtually impossible. It was also pointed out to me that there was a recent fella up in Casper who was discharged from the Economic Development Agency up there, and I think it's the local paper. They put in a request to the city of Casper. They want every communication that the city or any of the city's employees had with this guy. You think that's going to take a while? You think that's going to take 3 days? Think it's going to disturb their operations? Mr. Chairman, I think, again, I agree with the intent of this bill, but I really think both of these topics should be put into an interim study so we can also hear from the people who are in these smaller political subdivisions, the people who are most affected by this. And if we're not, and if we're going to impose this on it, I don't know how in good conscience we can exempt the legislature from it.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not a reporter. I've never been a reporter. However, I do have some answers, I think, to some of the questions that are coming up, and I pulled them out of the committee hearing. One of them was about the timelines. And if you look at this, it does refer to reasonable time shall be presumed to be 3 working days or less. Now, I asked the people who are testifying what they meant by this and the impact. And the example that was given of over a thousand pages or 1,000 records or whatever it was, when I looked at the language of this, the question that I ask is, who has to pay for this? And contained in that language is that basically the requesters have to. And what I was thinking about was in my home county, where things are tight and staff has been cut back, there aren't extra people standing around leaning on the copy machine. And so the question was, in committee, if you don't have somebody to come up with those records, the requester, and I think the language is contained in here, the requester becomes responsible for the overtime. It may be for a new contract employee to take on that specific thing. The language already addresses that in that somebody can't walk in and say, I want all the records for the last 10 years. And I think the answer to that, as contained in the bill, is certainly we'll prepare a bill for you and we'll prepare approximately how many people we're going to have to hire that you'll need to pay for. And so there is some checks and balances in here. And it does provide for that. It's not on the back of the citizens. That was one of my concerns. Can this be abused and onto the back of the citizens? Because you do have people who walk in, and I've experienced it, who say, I want to know what happened every meeting that was ever associated with this one development and all the conversations that go back several years. And the farther we dig, the farther we find. The more we find. And the farther we dig, and the more we find. And this bill does allow for the people who make those kind of requests, they're going to need to either be pretty serious or have pretty deep pockets to fund that request, essentially. And so that was comforting to me in light of having to go home and face my county clerk.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a little concerned with what we heard in some recent testimony, because as I read page 4, lines 1 through 4, where it says cost for labor may be charged only when the request requires the custodian to compile data or extract data or redact information in order to create a new document to comply with a public record request. So, Mr. Chairman, as I read that, if the individual does come off the street and say, I want everything there is out there, the original copy related to wolves that has gone on in the state of Wyoming in the last 5 years, and I don't want a copy of it, I would just like to look at it, which we see on page 3, I can inspect it, then at that point, I have no idea, Mr. Chairman, how many human hours it would take to do that. But I can assure you it's going to be on the people's dime, not the requester's dime. And if that's not the intent, you know, there's an awful lot of language here that seems to be specifically crafted on lines 3 and 4. We've got 9 lines of language that are quite specific in assuring that only the reasonable costs shall not exceed the actual cost of duplication on the record. It goes to great length to make sure that there's no additional charge. And I'm certainly concerned with the cost as well, Mr. Chairman, and I can foresee a situation where somebody comes in each and every day making a new request. And we have to answer that request, Mr. Chairman, within 3 days or 7 days unless we have a specific need. So as this is written, it can be quite onerous. And, you know, the only way I would hope to see this go forward, and I think that we should be very considerate of the cost, is maybe some type of amendment, Mr. Chairman, that would allow for charging under additional circumstances.
Senator Dockstetter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just respond to some of this. We can adjust the time frame if needed, if that's one of the major concerns. We need to make that track in better with the public bodies that are out there. And concerns about whether it's someone's dime or how many millions we're spending, we just finished a budget. Think about the millions that was in that budget, millions of dollars. And now I'm asking that you just simply allow the public to track that down, make sure that we know what we're doing out there in these public agencies is right. We're going to spend millions of dollars. That's all the more reason, no matter their size. Granted, there are these smaller districts, but aren't they still using the public money? I think what it comes down to, and I hear some concerns out there, but I think what it has to come down to, members of the Senate, is our access and the people's access to information in the state of Wyoming. If we were concerned about whether we were lobbied on this or not, I came down here and opened a drawer and wondered when I was lobbied on all of those. I don't remember that. It comes down to public information. It's fundamental to self-government. I call for the question.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, as we work through these bills over the next couple of days, I've now listened to the argument, it occurs to me that for a lot of the issues, there's two principal motivations or folks that want to have this information and that they would like to have it quickly. And I think it's worth thinking about as we go through there. One group of people, of course, and we know are folks that would like to use them to print media and would like to sensationalize everything that they get. And, you know, there are there's a whole group of people out there that enjoy the sensationalism. And you can turn on the TV any day, and you can watch people prepared to dramatize everything from moment to moment, do it on TV. And frankly, if those are the people that you want to run your cities, towns, and counties, have at it. Now, there are another group of people out there who are more private, want to be more deliberate, want to test their ideas, be able to debate without the fear of having their statements sensationalized and thrown in the paper the next day. And certainly if the information comes out years later or a month later, it's different than if it comes out in 3 days or 7 days. We see presidential libraries locked up for years to avoid some of that. Now, there's another group of people that want this information equally bad. And those are people that, cases that involve property rights. They're people that, I've represented for these people. Now, I'll give you two groups of people that, just for example. One is physicians, for example, who find themselves in a fortunate situation where their privileges are being revoked by a hospital. And I've been on that side, and I can tell you that as soon as an action is taken, you want every bit of information you can, and then you want the transcripts, if there are, of any executive session. I'll give you another one. We've been talking a lot about teacher privileges. Once again, you have a property right, and there's going to have to be a deliberative effort in executive session to make a decision, hopefully without lawyers. And the first thing you want to do is find out to get that information. And why? Because we know as attorneys that, frankly, these boards aren't very well trained. They're just regular people. And you begin to find out things that they talked about that are irrelevant, and that begins the process. And the sooner you can get it, the better. And if you want to know how you take a simple decision to revoke a physician's privileges or to take a teacher and deny them or terminate their contract, and you want to draw that off to 2 years, give me these records. I mean, that's the beginning spot. So those are things to be keeping in your mind as sort of what are we trying to do here as we go through. Certainly, many things the public has a right to know. But at the same time, if you want to terminate teachers, and you want to be able to, or terminate bad teachers, not good ones, but if you want to do that in an expeditious way, you need to be thinking about what is the impact of it. And if you want to provide information, and if you want to have the deliberative process open, we could take our juries out there and we could say, okay, all juries that are considering cases, we're going to film the jury. In fact, we're going to go out and sell it on the news because it'll make great, great fun and great entertainment. And it seems to be that a lot of people will find that entertaining. And we could do that. We could open up all the juries and do it. And now what we're going to do is take this deliberative process, no different than a jury, and open it up and watch it through the glass. Now, I can assure you that there are plenty of trained people that are going to, and some of those people in that room are going to love it. They're going to grandstand. They're going to say all the great stuff that'll make good print and embarrass their colleagues. And they're going to be running the agenda now because everything they're going to get said is going to get published. And the people that are just trying to get through, oftentimes doing a good job and trying to quiet this down, that don't enjoy being in there, they're not going to be heard. Thank you.
The question has been called for. All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 126, say aye. 121, excuse me. 121, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
That bill has failed. House Bill 121 has failed. The chair will allow the division. All in favor, stand, please.
Opposed? Pursuant to Senate Rule 11-5, having failed a standing division vote, a roll call vote is required. The Chief Clerk will call the roll.
Barnard?
No.
Bebout?
No.
Burns?
No.
Case?
No.
Christensen?
Aye.
Coe?
No.
Cooper?
Aye.
Dockstader?
Aye.
Driscoll?
No.
Emmerich?
No.
Esquivel? Geis?
No.
Hastert?
Aye.
Hicks?
No.
Hines?
No.
Jennings?
No.
Johnson? Excused.
Yes.
Landon?
No.
Martin?
Aye.
Meyer?
No.
Nicholas?
No.
Nutting?
No.
Perkins?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
Rothfuss?
No.
Schiffer? Scott?
No.
Von Platern?
Aye.
President Anderson?
No.
Closing vote? Closing. Vote closed. 10 ayes, 19 noes, 1 excused.
House Bill 121 has failed. The next bill for our consideration is... Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, if I may have privilege of the floor, I would ask my colleagues to please help me welcome another class of the Rollins High School government class that comes to see how the Wyoming Senate operates. Thank you.
Senator Case.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that you completed announcing the votes on the last one, especially the part about it being pursuant to joint rule and being indefinitely postponed. So there's a little bit more to it than that.
You were correct, Senator Case. House Bill 121, having failed a roll call vote pursuant to Senate Rule 11-5A, is deemed indefinitely postponed. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 167.
House Bill 167, Castle Doctrine Modifications, an act relating to crimes and offenses, sponsored by Representative Qualberg. It was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Burns, Christensen, Esquivel, Hicks, and Perkins, Senator Perkins, Chairman.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the committee hold rise to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 167, and for an explanation of the bill, I ask you to call on its co-sponsor, my good friend, and I yield the floor to my good friend from Natrona County, Senator Jennings.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you remember, several years ago, we had a really cool debate on the Castle Doctrine, and there were predictions of blood and death and all that. None of that ever happened. But what we did do in that is that we kind of missed something, is that as we went through the statute, the word... home or habitation kind of flowed through the statute as the word, and we had one place in there where we called it an occupied structure. So all this bill does is it's kind of a go back into the statute, take that occupied structure out, put home and habitation in, because that's what's really flows through the rest of the statute. It has a definition as used in this section. Habitation means any structure which is designed or adapted for overnight accommodations, including but not limited to buildings, modular units, trailers, campers, and tents. Home means any occupied residential dwelling. So it basically goes back, puts in the words that we probably used when we had the really fun debate on this and straightens out the statute. I hope you vote aye. Stand for any questions.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I want to ask a couple of questions. You've got two different definitions here. How are they, what's the importance in their use in the underlying law here? And I was just trying to figure out, suppose you had a hotel such as some of us live in that is designed for long-term or medium-term residential use, and some of the places that people stay in, for instance, are of that nature. Is that a home or is that a habitation?
Senator Jennings.
Mr. Chairman, I believe my interpretation would be a home because it means any occupied residential dwelling. So if you have a long-term extend stay, that would be a residential dwelling and fall under home. But it really doesn't make any difference because it says home or habitation, so both definitions should apply.
Question has been called for. All of those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 167, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? House Bill 167 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 190.
House Bill 190, Electronic Fine Submittal, an act relating to the courts, sponsored by Representative Dave Zwanitzer. It was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins. Senator Perkins, Chairman.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Committee of the Whole rise and report that do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 190 and for an explanation of the bill. I'm trying to remember who this went to, and I don't see any takers. if you would like to do it, I'd ask you to call the senator from the Ivory Towers and have him take this one on. This one came through our committee. In our committee, what this is about is ultimately it's a fairly simple bill, streamlining and updating and pulling the court into the 21st century. The meat of the bill is on page 2. A Supreme Court may authorize, develop, and implement an electronic transaction system via the internet or technology or other similar medium for submittal or of payment to the circuit court of all fines, penalties, and fees, and for bonds for misdemeanor offenses, where bonds may be. So ultimately what it is just the is authorized the court to go ahead with that process so that you can still go in and pay in cash. You can still go in and offer the king's legal tender if you want, or you can dial up and put it in by, with your PayPal or by your card or however you want to do that, your credit card. And then the only other thing authorizes the Supreme Court to accept that payment. And then on D, lines 2 and 3, it makes it clear that in addition to that, it'll be a lot like an ATM. Any fee that's associated with the entity that provides that form of electronic payment, that if there's a fee that's charged in addition to that, whether it's a percentage or a flat fee, that'll be paid by the person in addition to the fine, so that the state, and in particular the children, will get their appropriate and full share. With that, I ask your favorable consideration and stand for questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Schiffer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, one small question for the sponsor of the bill. On page 2, line 14, subparagraph B, where they're talking about the Supreme Court can lower a fine, I need a little more explanation. I have great faith in those five folks. that ever so often they do something right. But what's that mean? I mean, tell me more about that. It's a new statute, and I didn't know they could do those sort of things.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. To tell you folks what the general policy is with respect to these. We're now dealing with this generically throughout government, and the position is generally this. Ordinarily, in the commercial world, if you're going to get a discount, you get a discount for paying cash, not by credit. Now what happens is that credit card companies oftentimes have agreements with their vendors that the vendor will not charge the customer for a fee so that the vendor has to take a 3% transaction fee off of it. The general position of the state is that most fees and costs are, in a sense, a tax. The tax has to be paid equally by everybody in the state. And if you want to pay by a credit card, that's fine. But you don't get a discount and shift the cost of government to your people that are paying cash and by checks. Rather, if you want the convenience of paying by the credit card, you have to pay the fee. So as a general rule, we require that anywhere where there's fees or taxes paid and you're allowing to be payment by a credit card, that the transaction fee has to be charged back. And if the credit card will not allow it, then we simply say you can't pay that way then, because everybody has to pay the same. It's not fair that the cost of government, your taxes, are going to be less than your neighbor's so that you can put it on your credit card. So, and what we found, by the way, is that while the credit card companies insist that that be the process, when it comes to government agencies, they finally figured out that that's the way life is. So we say, look, if you want to make money off your customers and use government customers, they have to pay the cost, so we charge back the credit card fee. Now, in this language that my colleague from KC just talked about, it appears to be, my assumption is that it was an authorization to reduce your fine by the credit card charge so that you don't have to do this fight. I submit to you, if that is it, that's bad practice. We ought to say, no, if you want to pay your fine is the same as everybody else's for that transaction, and you must pay the transaction charge. Now, If it's an early payment and you get to do it and you get a further discount, I'd like to get part of that deal, too, even if I pay with cash. In fact, I want a greater discount. So we get more discussion on that.
Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm not sure who to address this to, if I'm who the sponsor is, because they're not really here. But I guess I had the concern, too, over the fees portion of this and the reductions. You know, sitting on in committee number two this year, we had numerous agencies and individuals coming in wanting anywhere from tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of dollars to maintain websites. And is this all going to be done through the Supreme Court website? Is there a new website created? It says on the back that that it was indeterminable, the fiscal impact, because they didn't have time for process. So what is this going to mean in the future? We open up Pandora's box. Is this going to be something that's going to be very expensive? I'm not sure what we're completely voting on here.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I think the remedy on that in subsection B, lines 14 and 15, is just to strike a reduction and insert an increase, and then we would be in concert with page 3, paragraph D, which says that any fee assessed for processing a credit card payment shall be borne by the person tendering payment. But the good senator from the far side of the state is correct that there's a lot more associated with processing these than just the processing fee, because you're going to have equipment and data handling and IT people. And frankly, this is kind of like a bill that we had earlier today that didn't have an appropriation on it that probably should have went to the Appropriation Committee. Wouldn't you say so?
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, in defense of my committee chairman, some of the confusion over being a floor manager here was the fact that even the House chairs didn't really do most of the preaching for this bill in our committee. It was actually the Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court, and she came and spoke to us and did most of the talking about this bill. And my chairman actually asked the House sponsors if they had a floor manager, and they said they'd get back to him, and apparently they didn't. So that's why everybody's looking around for a manager on this thing.
Senator Von Flatter.
Mr. Chairman, before you call a question, I would like to answer the question. You know, I set up a credit card system a couple 4 years ago. It's $50 a month and like $12 minimum fee unless you have transactions. That goes away. It's $50. Did it on a computer. Somebody on the phone gave me their numbers. Any clerk can do it anywhere. There's no big websites involved. It's a real slam dunk, and it's a great idea.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I hate taking one for a bill I didn't even have my name on. But anyway, vote it up, vote it down. But the testimony that we had in committee from the Supreme Court was actually, and just to make a clarification, that any fees that are charged have to be charged and paid by the person who's paying the fine. That's at the top of page 3. The testimony that we had with respect to paragraph B, which is on page 2, lines 14 through 19, was that there is a floor that's set there. The bond, the fine, penalty, or bond shall not be less than the minimum fine for the specified offense. So there's a floor in there. But the object was, and the purpose was, that it takes a significant amount of clerk time to handle these transactions. So if you come in and you pay cash or you pay by other means and you do that, you've got to have a clerk that's up there. They've got to account for that stuff. They have to put it in the cash drawer. Then at the end of the day, they have to do the drawer. And so that the more that they can get the move to, and this isn't for the Supreme Court. This is for the circuit courts. This is for your fines. This is where most of your fines are going to be paid. And that they thought that actually would save time, would save money, and would act in the form of less staff. And that in doing that, that they could encourage people by giving a payment reduction for paying electronically, and that reduced the transaction cost to the circuit court, that it was worth their while. That's the testimony. And without a floor manager here to defend that, you know, vote her up, vote her down, Mr. Chairman. Have at it.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion that when the committee of whole rise to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 190, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The chair is in doubt. All those in favor, say aye. Rise, please.
Free food in the kitchen.
Those opposed?
It hasn't passed the voice vote yet. The voice vote's become an adventure this year.
Pursuant to. Oh, did pass?
Passed.
Okay.
You have to turn it over.
House Bill 190 has passed. What was the vote again, Madam Clerk? 16-12. Thank you.
It's a win in my book.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, if I could have the privilege of the floor. For the third and last time today, members of the Senate, could you please help me welcome Rollins High School government class coming to see how the Wyoming State Senate operates.
The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 202. Clerk will read the bill, please.
House Bill 202, Railroads Fence Repairs, an act relating to railroads, sponsored by Representative Brown. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State Public Lands, and Water Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Driscoll, Emmerich, Geis, and Hicks. Senator Geis, Chairman.
Senator Geis.
When the Committee of the Whole rises and report, I move that House Bill 202 do pass. I'll yield the bill to Senator Bebout.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, we have a fencing bill here for the members of the Senate to consider, and it really is a fencing bill. Mr. Chairman, what happens in reality where we have a railroad that they're responsible to put up a fence, and they put the fence up, and a lot of times, and I'm sure you're all aware of that this fence will be in need of repair, and there's language in existing law 379312 that there's a notification procedure that they go through for the railroad and the department, and the railroad's responsible to repair that, or if they, in fact, don't, to reimburse the landowner. Reality, sometimes what happens is they don't get out there in time, and the landowner has a prized bull or whatever may be the case out there, and they certainly don't want to have it on the track. So they go out there and they fix the fence themselves. But there are some issues about liability. Since they, in fact, repaired that portion of the fence, then the railroad could take the position that while you fix that fence, it's your responsibility, and if something should happen, i.e. an animal get through that, we're not going to be responsible for that. So, Mr. Chairman, what the bill does, if you look on page 2, lines 11 through 13, it says, repairs made by a landowner pursuant to this section shall not be deemed to create any continuing duty or any landowner liability. And, Mr. Chairman, the line above it just says that if it's not 3 to 5 days and you want to mutually agree upon a different timetable, that you can do that. I would be glad to answer any questions.
Senator Bebout, next time pull the mic a little closer. There you go. Questions have been called for. All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 202, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? House Bill 202 has passed Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I move that request that the Committee of the Whole stand at ease for a short break for about 5 minutes.
That request is granted.
Thank you.
threw him out.
I'll gavel this back in. Just for one bill.
Oh, okay.
I'm fine.
I'm going to get this.
Got enough?
14 if you gamble, you might get them.
Committee of the Whole, come back to order.
We don't have a quorum yet.
We're working on a quorum. We have a quorum. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 206. Will the clerk please read the bill?
House Bill 206, Emergency Response Incidents, an act relating to the Wyoming Emergency Response Act, sponsored by Representative Throne. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations, Election, Political Subdivisions, who reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Hines, Johnson, Martin, Case, and Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Case?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a do pass recommendation on House Bill 206, Emergency Response Incidents. And then for an explanation of the bill, I would yield to the good senator from Laramie County. And I'd also, before I yield, though, I'm not sure that vote was actually correct. It definitely did pass the committee, but I believe there was one no vote. But I'll come check it.
Yeah, I know who it was.
Senator Amrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a clarification type bill. This clarifies some language in a 2008 bill about emergency response to essentially meth houses. We've had a few clandestine labs in the state. There were 10, I think, busted in 2009. And this bill clarifies that clandestine labs, because of their potential danger associated with the chemicals, is considered an emergency response. As far as the bill goes, you can see the added language on page 2, or clandestine laboratory investigation, also on the bottom of page 2. And I will have to admit, I don't know why aviation is added in on page 3. In case you've got a lab in a airplane, maybe. But essentially, it's trying to take into consideration a home that was a meth lab here in Cheyenne, or here in a city in the southeast corner, that has remained vacant, I believe, now for 3 years because no one wants to go in and clean it up, and it is a absentee landlord. This bill would help us at least to use this emergency response bill to clean up this meth lab because there is so much toxic chemicals involved in producing methamphetamine that whenever a lab is present, it contaminates everything that is surrounding it. So I would urge your yes vote on this bill, and if you have questions, I will try to answer them for you.
The point of order is taken. It was misread. Would the clerk please reread the bill?
Mr. President, your committee number 7, this was referred to committee number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Hines, Johnson, and Martin. No, Senator Case and Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
Senator Case, as a point of order, would you like to reintroduce the bill?
I'll speak if it's all right. I'm satisfied with the procedure to date and the record being cleared up. I would like to speak on the bill.
Senator Case, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I felt uncomfortable with this bill partly because it adds this situation involving this house in Laramie County where it's actually been sitting vacant for a lot of years. And what we're doing is we're making it fit into the area where you can have emergency responders and all the implications of having emergency responders come. You know, when you pick up, when your garage is on fire, nobody really cares if they cut through jump through the roof in your house and put it out, or they drag your car out of the way or do all that because it's an emergency. There's lots of implications about liability, but when you have an emergency, we all agree and we have special kind of things that happen. To add that this is an emergency, and that it brings in kind of all these protections and all this stuff bothered me a bit because actually this has been going on for 7 years, I guess. It's not exactly abandoned. There's just a disagreement. Is it an imminent threat, like my garage is on fire, and I didn't think that it really rose to that. It seems like we've been trying to work our way around this one a couple of different times, Mr. Chairman. We even appropriated money for it a few years ago in another bill, and I guess that money's still available. But I'm not sure that this gets to where they need to be either, and I just have a hard time defining this to the level to bring in this act, which is, I believe it's called the Emergency Response Act, and to amend that act to deal with this situation when actually it's a very passive situation that's been sitting there for 7 years.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I was the other no vote in committee and rather different reason. Mr. Chairman, I think the bill is before us is harmless. I think you can pass it and nothing bad's going to happen. And maybe something good will, maybe. My concern was that I had difficulty understanding how passing this bill was going to allow them to effectively deal with these meth houses. And you can go in, given some time and some cost, you can go in, the testimony, you can go in, particularly using heat, you can drive the volatile chemicals off and in fact, make them safe. It's not necessarily cheap, but it's cheaper than taking a bulldozer to the place usually. And I couldn't see how this bill was going to give them the power to get that done. But apparently the city attorney involved here thinks it will. I'm just skeptical, and I will predict we'll have another bill in another year or two.
Senator Raffas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a quick question for the sponsor. I was wondering if contaminated is defined anywhere in statute. It's not in the definitions listed here. It seems like a relatively vague term, and I didn't know if there was any previous statute that would kind of shed some light onto that, Mr. Chairman, or if that's just a wide-open term.
Senator Emmerich.
To the good senator from the Ivory Tower, I haven't a clue.
Senator Esquivel.
Mr. Chairman, speaking in favor of this bill, and as a good senator from Natrona County mentioned, nothing bad will happen if this bill is passed, and something good might come from it. Certainly, there are some valid concerns. However, as the good senator from Fremont County mentioned, this situation has been in existence for a number of years, and efforts to correct that situation, and I'm sure there's others in the state that require some type of affirmative action, and hopefully this bill will accomplish that result. So I would ask that you look with favor on this bill, and thank you for your time.
Question being called. All those in favor of House Bill 206 passing the committee of the whole, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
Would the ayes please stand? Nays, please stand. House Bill 206 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 211. Would the clerk please read the bill?
House Bill 211, County Memorial Hospital Board Members Removal and Act Relating to County Memorial Hospitals. Sponsored by Representative Throne. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Martin, and Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Case?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 211, County Memorial Hospital Board Members Removal. There is a standing committee amendment. I'd ask it be read in at this time.
Would the clerk please read the amendment?
House Bill 211, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 2, line 3.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the standing committee amendment to House Bill 211, and for an explanation of the bill and the amendment, I'd yield to the good senator from the county just west of the mother county.
Senator Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 211, County Memorial Hospital Board Members Removal. And what this short little bill does is authorizes the county commissioner to be able to remove a member from the hospital board of trustees. If you go to Wyoming Statute 188104, subsection A, In that subsection A, the commissioners are authorized to appoint a board of trustees composed of at least 5, but not more than 11, and of competent and responsible citizens of the county appointed by the board of commissioners. The statute is silent in regard to the commissioner's ability to remove a board member, and in the commissioner's ability to fill a vacancy on the board when a member leaves before the end of their term or has been removed. Subsection A, it indicates that each trustee shall serve until the first Monday of July following the expiration of their term, and the Board of County Commissioners annually at their meeting in June shall appoint a successor to the trustee or trustees. Whose term expires, and that's the only time in the statute that they talk about filling a vacant position, or when they're reappointing, or when somebody's term has expired and they don't want to be reappointed. So, if you turn to page 2 of the bill, it has a new subsection E, which would read, the county commissioners may remove any member of the board of trustees for just cause without a public hearing, and vacancies on the board of trustees shall be filled by the county commissioners for the balance of the unexpired term created by the vacancy. If we could take up the amendment now, Mr. Chairman, the amendment is on page 2, lines 3. After hearing, you would insert, unless the trustee requests a public hearing, and that... So in the first sentence there, it says the county commissioners may remove any member of the board of trustees for just cause without a public hearing unless the trustee requests a public hearing. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would call for the question on the amendment.
Questions on the amendment? Senator Nicholas.
Thank you. On the amendment. So disregarding whether you like the bill or not, an elected member of the trustees, appointed a member of the trustees, and then you're going to fire him. And what's the nature of this public hearing?
Senator Martin.
Mr. Chairman, this is not an elected board. This is appointed board for a before a County Memorial Hospital. The purpose of the hearing is if a member of the board was removed for just cause, the member that was being removed could request that a public hearing take place to discuss the reasons for the dismissal or removal.
Additional questions on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 on House Bill 211, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 on House Bill 211 is passed. Back on the bill. Question being called. All those in favor of House Bill. I'm sorry. Mr. Vice President, were you standing? Senator Nicholas.
So this is not a more elected Memorial Hospital District. They're only appointed by the local boards. Never heard of it.
Senator Martin.
Well, I understand that there's, and maybe the good chairman can help me with this, but there's only 7-8 county memorial hospitals in the state who have appointed boards. And but there's, once they're appointed, once if they've caused some problem either in the hospital or on the board, there's no way to remove them prior to the end of their appointed term. And that's, the statute is 18-8-104, Hospital Generally Under Control of Board of Trustees, Appointment Powers and Duties of Trustees, Incorporation, Use of Funds for Erection of a Hospital, Term of Lease, Consolidation of Hospitals, and Acquisition of Land.
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, I'll buy some time while our good vice president looks up the statute, but this does apply only to appointed boards, as was represented in the committee. It deals with a situation when you can appoint them, but you can't remove them. The original bill was amended to put in the words just cause, and, of course, the standing committee amendment, which we just passed, adds at least a way for the trustee that's being removed to request a public hearing and to have one so be held. So that's the bill.
Thank you, Senator Case. Senator Raffas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I had it up on my screen, and then as I was standing up here, I scrolled all the way back down. So that was an epic fail. There we go. Yes. Mr. Chairman, to clarify, it says that the erection, management, and control of the County Memorial Hospital, County Memorial Hospital Fund, and all property and funds received for the benefit of the hospital shall be by a board of trustees composed of at least 5 but not more than 11 competent and responsible citizens of the county appointed by the Board of County Commissioners. So this particular statute is specific to appointed boards, not the elected boards that we're familiar with in other cases. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Perkins.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the good senator from the Ivory Towers with that. But now that raises another question. This, if they can only be terminated for just cause, you know, if qualifications are that they be responsible and competent, then just cause would say that they have to be irresponsible or incompetent. I mean, ultimately, I think that's where the bill is right now, and I'm wondering if that's really where you want it.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I think we'd be much better off without the just cause, but I didn't have the votes in committee. So I would encourage you to try that in second reading.
Any additional comments on the bill? Seeing none, all those in favor of House Bill 211, passing the committee of the whole, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
House Bill 211 is passed the committee of the whole. This bill for consideration is House Bill 215. Would the clerk please read the bill?
House Bill 215, Department of Health Reorganization, Act Relating to the Administration of Government. It was
Senate by Representative Lubnow. It was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Dockstader, Martin, Nutting, Schiffer, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Hastert, Nicholas, Peterson, Von Flateren. No, Senator Meyer, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move from the Committee of the Whole rise and report to do so with the recommendation that House Bill 215 do pass. There was a standing committee amendment. I ask it be read in at this time.
House Bill 215, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 2, line 16.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Chairman, I move adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. Mr. Chairman, to explain both the bill and the Standing Committee Amendment, this is the reorganization bill in the Department of Health. It comes to you at the request of the governor and is a reflection of the deep concerns that we've got with the Department of Health and particularly the Medicaid program there. We all know, we've discussed at length on this floor, the problems in the Medicaid budget area. And this is an attempt to deal with that organization. Mr. Chairman, the thinking in the executive branch has evolved since this bill was originally written, and the amendment reflects that change in thinking and reflects the other developments that have happened. Mr. Chairman, as you look at the bill, on page 2, lines 4 through 12, there's a provision there that the chief administrator of the Medicaid program shall be the Medicaid agent within the department, who shall be appointed by the governor and shall serve at the pleasure of the governor. That stays, that the governor and the new health department director want to do it that way, and they're real strong on it. And that's a key portion of the bill. And frankly, Mr. Chairman, that reflects the importance of the Medicaid program in our budget. This is one of our major programs, and the governor wants to have direct access to it. And he and the new director think they can make this arrangement work, and I think they will. Mr. Chairman, then on Section 2, as it comes to us from the House, there's a whole bunch of very specific criteria, and it's designed to drive a process that will, in a couple of years, lead to splitting the Medicaid program off from the Department of Health. And that's something, I think maybe about two-thirds of the states do it that way, and the other third do it the way we do right now with the Medicaid program as part of the Department of Health. The thinking there is evolving, and they're saying, wait a minute, we may not want to go that far. We've got a new director we have a lot of confidence in. There's some very real advantages to having the Medicaid program integrated with the rest of the Department of Health. And we aren't quite so sure we want to give those up. So what the amendment does, Mr. Chairman, first, the key part is on page 2, line 16, where it now says, Director of Department of Health shall, et cetera, says Director of Department of Health may. So it makes it discretionary. Then it changes the dates such that he has a choice. He can report back in the fall of 2011, the date was changed November 15th, 2011, give him a little extra time if he wants any changes considered at the budget session, or he can wait until September 1st, 2012, if he wants changes considered at the 2013 budget session. So it gives the new management some extra time and some flexibility, and then it takes out all the rest down through page 6, line 1, so that there's more flexibility there. And that's, I've talked to the original sponsor of the bill, talked to the governor's office, and they're fine with that. And then it says on page 6 that this reorganization requirement with that statutory reference is where you're creating a new department. It may well be that the new director will want to do some reorganizing within the department, which may or may not require some minor statutory changes. But what we're saying with the amendment on the and page 6 is that we'll only apply this section if they're creating a new department, because that's what it's appropriate to. So it gives them that flexibility, and then we leave intact the study money. And so that they've got some, you're giving the executive branch some options as to how they're going to approach the Department of Health. And, Mr. Chairman, I think with new management, it's entirely appropriate to give them some options, give them some tools to take a hard look, and then let them deal with the situation and come back to us if they need some statutory changes or if they decide they really do need a new department. And frankly, Mr. Chairman, I think that that's appropriate. The people are going to hold the governor responsible for the administrative performance of his departments, and he ought to be able to have the flexibility to do them the way he wants. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the standing committee amendment. I'd stand for any questions on the standing committee amendment.
Question. Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, I just have one question for clarification. And the word that the amendment change on page 2, line 16, the shall to may, I first read this, it say the director of the health may examine the program and function of the department. I would think if he's preparing a reorganization plan, he would have to. And I just wondered if I'm looking at this wrong, or my first thought maybe the shall should be, or the may be after the department. So I just like your comments on that to see if I'm following this correctly or incorrectly.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's safe to say that the director is going to examine the programs and function of the department. He's got to do that just to understand what he's got. The key thing is now the shall also applies to director of department shall, on line 18, prepare a plan for reorganization of the department and all of the programs providing Medicaid services. Mr. Chairman, that's where the change is really important. We're telling him he may do that. So once he's done the examination, he can go ahead and prepare a plan, or he can say, no, that's not a good idea. We can make the existing organization work just fine. So that's where the may is really important.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Another quick question just to see if I've got this tracking right on the change you've got on line 13 of the amendment, standing committee amendment. You've got after governor, you're inserting the language if it includes actions requiring changes in statutes. And so as I cut that into the bill, would be that ultimately that he would only submit the plan, the director would only submit the plan to the governor for approval if it includes actions requiring changes in statutes. And that just seemed to me a curious. I just didn't understand why you'd only require submission of a plan to the government for his approval, to the governor for his approval, only if it required changes in statutes. I'm confused about that.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, if you construe the language carefully there, department shall submit the plan to the governor. Department reorganization plan as approved by the governor, if it requires changes in statutes, shall be submitted to the committee. You know, if it requires changes in statutes, modifies, so it comes to the committee only if there's a statutory change required, and the reason for that is changing the statutes is our business, and that's an appropriate report from the committee. I'm sure we'll hear, Mr. Chairman, what's going on anyhow, but the formal report needs to come to us if there has to be a change in statutes.
Question has been called for. All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion to adopt a standing committee amendment number 1 to House Bill 215, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That amendment has passed.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I believe there's a standing committee amendment from committee number 2. I ask that be read in at this time.
House Bill 215, Standing Committee Amendment Number 2 to engross copy, page 6, line 9.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Standing Committee Number 2 to House Bill 215. All we did was on page 2. For the appropriation, we appropriated that to the Office of the Governor instead of the Office of the Department of Health. As the Governor is to conduct the study, we thought he ought to control the funds.
Question has been called for. All those in favor of Senator Nicholas's motion to adopt a standing committee amendment number 2 for House Bill 215, please say aye. Opposed? That amendment has passed. Senator Scott, you're back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any further questions on the bill. Otherwise, I call for the question.
Question has been called for. All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 215, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? House Bill 215 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 223. Reading clerk, please read the bill in, please.
House Bill 223, Property Disclosure Statement, Wind Estate, an act relating to property, sponsored by Representative Brown. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State, and Public Lands, Water Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Emmerich, Geis, and Hicks. No, Senator Driscoll. Excuse, Senator Bebout. Senator Geis, Chairman.
Senator Geis.
Mr. Chairman, when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, I move House Bill 223 do pass. And this is another wind bill. And all we're doing in this bill is property disclosure statement. And you go over on page 2, and it tells you what all you have to have in there. And then on line 4, the extent and location of any easements across the land known to seller or recorded to the records of the county clerk. And then on line 8, if the ownership of the wind estate has anyway been severed in the chain of title from the surface estate, and this takes effect to July 1, and after July 1, you'll have to record this if you've severed your wind energy from the surface right of your estate, and that's all this does.
Question has been called for. All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 223, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? House Bill 223 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 259.
House Bill 259, Ethanol Producer Tax Credit and Acts Relating to Taxation and Revenue, sponsored by Representative Dave Zwanitzer. It was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Barnard, Case, Emmerich, and Hines. No, Senator Perkins. Senator Hines, Chairman.
Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it does so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 259. I would yield it to somebody, but I don't see a Senate sponsor. As I understand House Bill 259, it has to do with the ethanol producer tax credit, and I believe it was in 2003, there was a tax credit granted to a business, and rather than end this program completely at this point to fulfill the obligations of paying a tax credit or allowing a tax credit for 15 years, we're allowing that to continue and setting the date of July 1st, 2011 that would be ending this program of tax credits. So basically, from July 1st, 2011, there would be no more tax credit granted on any future business or expansion in Wyoming. The one business that is have expanded under this program would be allowed to continue for the period from 2003 for 15 years after that. Try to answer any question. If not, I ask for your support.
Senator Case.
And, Mr. Chairman, there was testimony in the committee that far from being necessary to have these incentives and tax credits now, that ethanol is actually mandated as a fuel additive. You know, it's here, it's everywhere, and there's going to be more of it, especially as we go to the percentage of 15% in gasoline. In fact, it's very, very difficult to find gasoline without ethanol. It's almost impossible, in fact. There is one station in Cheyenne I'll tell you about if you want to know. The need for this for new plants really, really does not exist. And so it's time to move on.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering if somebody who is in the committee listening to testimony could comment on the July 1st, 2011 deadline. Is there any active facility being built, or are we just assuming that this is going to end it for all and that time happens to be out in the future, but it's inconsequential? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, there was no testimony in committee that there is any proposal for a new ethanol plant or for any expansion at this period that anyone have planned or gave notice. And I believe the they was set this date. I can't give you an exact reason why they set it at July 1st. The bill goes into effect immediately, and I guess this would be a public notification. If there is one that is already started, then they could apply before July 1st.
Question's been called for. All those in favor of Senator Hines' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 259, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
House Bill 259 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Joint Resolution Number 1.
House Joint Resolution Number 1, District Court Commissioners Authority, a joint resolution proposing to amend the Wyoming Constitution to expand the authority of District Court Commissioners, sponsored by the Judiciary Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, and Perkins. Excuse, Senator Hicks. Senator Perkins, Chairman.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, they do so with a favorable recommendation on House Joint Resolution 1. And ask for favorable consideration. With your indulgence, Mr. Chairman, I'll explain the bill. What we have in the Wyoming Constitution, Article 5, Section 14, it specifically provides that district court commissioners may only act if the district judge is absent from the county. Mr. Chairman, in what we've encountered today is with search warrants, with certain jobs and instances, the load that we put on district court commissioners, they simply can't get to all the work that's done. And so we have district court commissioners that work part-time on a basis. They help keep the costs down in the courts by and help with the timely issuance of search warrants. Search warrants are some other times that they, I think, participate in some involuntary commitment proceedings. But they have a limited role, but a very vital role in keeping justice moving forward, and particularly in resolving it in a timely manner for our citizens. However, what we have in statute is in order for these individuals to work, they can only do it when the district court's absent from the county. That becomes impractical, and that many times it's simply because the district court judges' dockets are full. If you have these emergent situations that arise, they just get pulled in too many directions. And so what this would do is would amend this to allow what is actually, I'm sad to report, is actually common practice now, that you have district court commissioners who are acting even when the judge is in the county. But what this would do is assist in people receiving decisions and search warrants and other things in a more timely fashion. It would help the administration of justice and help with timeliness with respect to the issuance of a number of these orders and determinations, so they can be made on a timely basis. That's the explanation of the bill. It's very simple. It's obviously a constitutional amendment. It requires two-thirds vote. And with that, it was an interim topic that came to us. Was asked, particularly by the Wyoming Supreme Court, has asked for this to make sure that that places where this is happening, that folks can't, that this can, it won't, that to make sure that the district court commissioners and their actions are constitutional within the Constitution. So, and with that, I'll stand for questions and ask for favorable consideration. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I do have some questions. I mean, historically, we've limited the role of these commissioners who are just volunteers paid by an hourly in your community. And we limited it for a purpose, and that is to make sure the judges attend to the work that they're elected to and appointed to perform. And frankly, if you're sitting there and you're an attorney or you happen to be a person who might be the other end of a subpoena, you know that it's before they get a subpoena, they've got to go through the judge unless he's absent. And for the civil action, I suppose this would apply to preliminary injunctions and things like that. So I call over and the judge is too busy, so then I call one of these other commissioners who are two or three lawyers in town, pals of mine, and I call over and said, hey, I want to come over and do a preliminary injunction, walk over to his office and get it. Or perhaps I don't think the judge is going to give me the preliminary injunction or the subpoena, so I don't even call to find out if he's too busy. I just walk over across the street, maybe across the hallway to my buddy who's over there and have him sign one. I suspect the framers of our Constitution had something in mind. They knew we have a pretty close-knit bar. Lawyers know each other, and they wanted them to restrict their business to the chamber business, which are ministerial things, but not major type of dispositive motions and things like that. So I guess it deserves some discussion. as to whether we really want to open these powers up to people that are not elected, that are not employees of the state, and have private practices.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, what we learned in the committee from the Chief Justice was that this has been, it's been going on. It has to do with caseload, and it's been working in the past, and this resolution is merely to address a practice that's already been taking place. And we didn't, there wasn't really any talk about abuses or problems that have been out there, so I suggest that maybe the practice that's been happening today has already answered the question.
Senator Jennings.
My colleague from Natrona County can, Mr. Chairman, can help me with this. They're already doing it, but it's against the Constitution. So we want to jump over here and change the Constitution to make what they're already doing legal. Mr. Chairman, I ask, if you can't trust the judiciary to obey the law, who are you going to trust?
Senator Rothfuss.
Mr. Chairman, I believe it's up to the executive branch to enforce the judicial branch to obey the Constitution. Mr. Chairman, I'm just curious. I don't understand a part of this amendment. And in the initial introduction, the focus was on in the absence of the district judge from the county. So assuming that this would have to go into effect when the district judge was out of the county. But there's this next clause, or upon his written statement filed with the papers, which seems to imply to me, and honestly, I could just be totally misunderstanding it because I have no idea what the intent of that is or what the papers are in this instance, but it implies that there can be an exception, Mr. Chairman. And I would just appreciate somebody who's more knowledgeable about this issue than I am could clarify that for me.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And being a layperson and not understanding the court system that well, I really need to know the difference between business and chamber business and just specifically what that expansion is. And if we can't do it verbally on the floor as this moves through, maybe a short little one page that draws those distinctions so we know what we're actually trying to do in amending the Constitution.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In answer to the question, some of the questions have been made, that the other was absent from the district judge, is absent from the county, or upon his written statement filed with the court that is improper for him to act. So ultimately, if he has a conflict of interest, or that's why the other one is there. As far as chamber business, ultimately, the object, or as near as anyone can figure, chamber business refers to those items that are not done in open court. They're things that are typically done ex parte, without a hearing. They are scheduling conferences. They are a review. Where they are now is typically the one that comes to mind immediately is search warrants. Those aren't done in open court. Those types of things, so that there's minimal due process issues when these arise. And so that's the difference between chamber business versus open court. The other part of this is, I think, in doing that is ultimately, if you look at that, they may act as prescribed by law. So you haven't thrown this wide open. Ultimately, the legislature has the ability to define when district court commissioners can act and when they are unable to act. And so in doing that, you've opened it up to where you can have a more rapid or efficient administration of justice, but you haven't thrown it wide open, and the legislature's reserved with, I believe this, as I read it, they're reserved to perform such other duties as may be prescribed by law, to take decisions, perform such other duties. So, in fact, we've got prescribed by law in there twice, so as if once wasn't enough. So that's the explanation. It's pretty straightforward. It is sad that, and I think that the judiciary has to take its lumps on that, that they have simply kind of looked the other way while secure. There's no question about that, and I don't think there's a particular excuse for that. But you know, that these types of things do affect the real citizens in the state, particularly in timeliness. We have a bill that we've debated with respect to DUIs where, you know, the importance of having a timely search warrants issued is of vital importance. So those are the types of things that are done. The legislature will have the opportunity to define those. We can define those in advance, or we can define those if we find that there's abuse. But ultimately, Mr. Chairman, ask for your favorable consideration. Thank you.
Are you ready for the question? Okay, Senator Meyer.
I want to understand this completely now, and I didn't know this. I mean, we can have a part-time attorney issuing search warrants, and if you have a search warrant, it's not issued by judges, and that's the current practice?
Senator Rothfuss.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow on that, when it says qualified in law, what does that mean? Are we using retired judges, or are we using lawyers, or are we using paralegals? I assume that's probably not the case, but what level does this actually rise to in practice?
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, what happens is that you have a lawyer who is generally a private practicing lawyer in town. These positions come open. They have a contract with the court to fulfill this duty, and they do it on an as-needed, on an hourly basis. And so typically they're experienced attorneys. They're not part-time attorneys. They're part-time commissioners is what the part-time is. It's not that much different than, for example, most of our municipal judges, many of our municipal judges are lawyers who are doing the same thing. They're under contract, and they're acting as judges. So, but it is a judicial officer, and they're acting in a judicial capacity when they're acting as a court commissioner.
Question has been called for. All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, that it do so with favorable recommendation of House Joint Resolution 1, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? House Joint Resolution number 1 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 40. Clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 40, Compensation for Persons Exonerated Based on DNA, an Act Relating to Criminal Procedure, sponsored by the Judiciary Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins. Chairman, Senator Perkins. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Hastert, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, Von Fladern, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
Senator Perkins.
Why me, Mr. Chairman? I want to thank my good friend, the Majority Floor Leader, for this new experience today. I think, quite frankly, this is also an interim topic. And my recollection was the majority of the Senate members voted no on this bill originally. But that being beside the point, Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report that it is with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 40, Compensation of Persons Exonerated from DNA. And, well, I don't remember who's supposed to explain this bill either, so. that finger's getting closer and closer, Mr. Chairman, and it's got me concerned. This was a joint interim bill, and you may have heard, Mr. Chairman, by way of background a study that's gone out, and they've looked, and I don't think it's any surprise to anybody in the chamber There's been a number of individuals over the last number of years across the country that have been cleared or exonerated from crimes from which they've been both accused, convicted, and incarcerated by the use of DNA. And as you go across, there's a certain project that's been across the country that has actually freed individuals based upon going back and looking and reexamining DNA and going back and looking at that. And so there's in that, and I think it was a year ago that we passed provisions that allowed, a year or two ago, that we actually set up the procedure for which a person can be exonerated from a crime for which they've been convicted based upon DNA and how that goes about and when it can happen. We set all those parameters in place a year or two ago and put that into statute. This is coming back and is the final provision of that. And what it is ultimately, what do you do for those individuals who have been wrongly convicted and incarcerated by the state of Wyoming? And so what this bill does is it comes out and it provides a mechanism by which these individuals can be compensated for their wrongful and for their incarceration, despite the fact that they were not guilty of the crime with which they were charged and convicted. What ultimately it did is it sets the bill comes by and it sets up on page 2, it sets the rate in time. It's I think it's $75 per day is what we've got. The $75 per day up to a maximum, if I remember right, of $300,000. Then we've got that set up so that ultimately that money would have to be appropriated by the legislature to do that. In doing that, if it was if our attorney, this individual was eligible, that if the amount accrued was over $30,000, it would come out to him initially in a sum of $30,000, and then would be paid in an annuity over the number of years as provided there on page 3. From there, ultimately, it goes down. When a person accepts this, if a person were to accept this payment, payment after their examination by the state, then in doing that, they have to waive their right to sue the state for any of the issues that may arise. There are certain actions called 1983 actions or other actions that can be brought against the state for depriving that individual of their liberty in a wrongful manner if they can prove that case. But if they can do that, if they accept this compensation, then they have to give up that right. So this is would in a sense be a kind of a settlement. This has been done throughout the country. There's a number of states that have these things. Wyoming is certainly, I believe my recollection is right, from that there's a majority of states that have some kind of compensation set up. I can represent to you that we don't have anybody that they've identified. There's a couple of cases that are reviewing, but we don't have anybody that this applies to at this point in time that's in our judicial system, although this group has identified a couple of cases they're going to look into. By its very nature, this doesn't go on forever. There's kind of a window of time as DNA has been kind of new and its use has come up. Ultimately, at some point, what you're looking for is DNA, or the certain testing wasn't particularly available at the time of conviction. Now it is. And so ultimately, as the DNA issues get better, this is less and less relevant. It goes on. But ultimately what it is a recognition and providing a mechanism by which individuals who have been convicted by the state, but convicted wrongfully and are then subsequently exonerated, receive some form of compensation from the state. Mr. Chairman, there is a standing committee amendment from the Appropriations Committee, and I'd ask that be read in at this time.
House Bill 40, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, to engross copy, page 2, line 3.
Thank you. And at that stage, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, if you'll call upon the Chairman of Appropriations.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, when this bill came to the Appropriations Committee, it didn't have an appropriation, and we were trying to sort out how this thing would work. And to do that, we brought in the folks from the Risk Management Office that exists in Department of Administration and Information, A&I. We brought over the Litigation Counsel and the Tort Division for the Attorney General's Office, and the testimony was that if this works in such a manner as to require that the person receiving compensation execute a release to the state of Wyoming where they release their civil rights actions, the compensation would be fair and it'd be appropriate. So in order to make the bill work in our current system, instead of having the money sent to the treasurer, what we're proposing is that the program would be administered through the risk management office at Division of A&I. As a practical matter, A&I, we put in $3 or $4 million a year into a risk pool that helps cover our costs. They're managing about all of the insurance for the state. They manage over-insurance for our various risks, and they pay out a substantial amount of claims every year. We've got some statistics on it, but when you see those claims that are being made against state employees that where there's liability or a settlement, they come out of the risk management office. So what we've done is said that the risk management office will manage this risk. They'll determine how to whether to settle it or not, and that the waiver or the release would be in a form that would be satisfactory to the Attorney General. So what we don't want to do is give an incomplete release, make a payment, and then find ourselves in suit for a civil rights action the next day. So as long as there's full and complete settlement, the testimony from the AG was that this would be it would be quick and judicious for the person who finds himself in this situation, and the compensation would be reasonable. There's no compensation going into the fund, so this becomes one more risk item. So as the risk management begins to assess their risk, then they come to the Appropriations Committee to seek an appropriation on an annual basis to cover the variety of risks that come to the state. Whether this will increase our risk insurance, we don't know. We'll just watch, and they'll have to do, along with their actuaries, an assessment of the risk there. But this will at least implement this in an effective manner through the risk management and assure that if we make the payments that we get a full and complete release. Would urge your support.
Senator Nicholas, will you move that amendment?
I will. I move Standing Committee Amendment 1 to House Bill 40 and ask your support.
Thank you. Question's been called for. All those in favor of Senator Nicholas's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 40, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Back on the bill. Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I can explain my other comments to you.
Senator Perkins, the amendment has passed. We're back on the bill now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, if I can explain my comments from earlier, this was an interim topic and was discussed. We've been looking at it for a number of years, the entire exoneration process. This, like I spoke about earlier, this is already in effect, and this is kind of the last piece of it. One of the reasons why some of us were not in the interim, were not particularly supportive of this particular bill, was because not because we're against the compensation, but just because ultimately, for me personally, I was against the concept that we'd simply pay somebody some money after having this happen to them, and then say to them goodbye and good luck. And that really troubled me. The testimony that we've had is that individuals that this has happened to, I can't imagine what it'd be like to be wrongly accused and convicted, and then spend, 10, 15, 20 years in prison, then be exonerated and come out. And what they find and what the testimony was is individuals that go through this process, it's almost like awaking from a coma. As you come out of a long incarceration, you come back into the world, it's almost like arising from a coma, and they have problems, as you can imagine, with readjustment. They have a number of mental health issues that arise. And so those issues are out there. And initially, some of the things that we had in this bill were things like training, like the opportunity to attend the university or community colleges or vocational programs in the state, that we had those issues in there initially to allow that to assist with that reentry, so that it's not just here's your $75 a day for the days that you were incarcerated. And by the way, you can't deduct the cost of incarceration from the $75. So you do end up with something for your trouble, but ultimately, that was one of the reasons I had the problem with this bill as it came out of the Joint Judiciary Committee. Again, not because of the concept that these individuals don't need help and shouldn't be entitled to some kind of compensation, but simply monetary compensation doesn't seem to be enough or appropriate. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Senate, I was chairman of this committee during the past couple of interims where we've been working on this project. I was a no vote during the interim, mainly because the bill as it stood at that point in time really did not bring in the governmental immunity statutes and waiver claims 139 and 101 through, 124 or something. But the bill, so that's why I had a problem with it then. The bill is much better now because we've taken into consideration, or the committee has since that time, taken into consideration my comments with regards to Governmental Claims Act. But like the good chairman of Judiciary now, I'm troubled by just a lump sum $300,000, here you go. Rather than providing, as the bill originally, as is being worked through the committee, had, you know, provided for services and retraining and things of that nature, rather than just give them a check. Quite frankly, I'm not sure after how many years you may be in prison, all of a sudden you get a $300,000 check or whatever, off you go, and they spend it or blow it, and we're still ultimately having to potentially pick up and provide services for an individual because they don't have any skill to manage that kind of money. And so that's why I was a no. I explained my previous no. I'm still a no.
Senator Rothfuss.
Mr. Chairman, I have three concerns along those lines. The first one is related to what we just heard from a good colleague from Laramie County. If you get $300,000 all at once, I assume this is taxable income. I don't know how it wouldn't be taxable income. I'm getting a head shake of no, so maybe it isn't, but okay, good, because that would be tragic. The second is why this is only exoneration based on DNA evidence and not other types of exoneration. If it's a clear exoneration, we're picking out one type of exoneration and selecting for that. And the third concern I would have is the $75, I'm just curious where that came from, that particular number. Is this based on other, there's a lot of actuarial type approaches to compensating people for a lost day of life, and I was wondering if this is related in any way to those types of actuarials, Mr. Chairman, or if it was just $75 seemed like a good number.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In answering those questions, I don't believe it's taxable simply because it's in the nature of emotional distress and those types of personal injury types of claims. And so generally those are not taxable. With respect to the other question, $75, I think, just came back. Initially, it was so much per year. And so it was so much per year. And ultimately, when you looked at that, obviously, it's the likelihood that you're going to be exonerated and released on the anniversary date of your incarceration is very unlikely. So my recollection is we simply divided the amount per year by the number of days per year and came up with the $75. You may be wondering why we didn't amend it in committee to reflect those changes, and it's just simply a philosophy that I have that ultimately the. When you have a judiciary bill that was worked as hard as this one was, that it just doesn't seem right to go back and mess with that committee bill as significant as it was. So if we want to bring amendments and move this forward and try and put some of those things back in the bill, I think that's wholly appropriate. It just didn't seem to me that it was appropriate that we subvert the work of the committee when it came into the committee for this hearing. If we want to move it forward, we can do that. We can decide if it's fair or not, and you can vote your conscience on how we do that. But I think that answers the questions that were outstanding. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, question for those who've indicated some opposition to the bill. Suppose we vote it down, then where are we? Now, I understand it may well be academic. We may not have anybody, or we may have somebody. But if the bill does not pass, what kind of circumstances are we in? Does the individual then have to sue with the potential that it costs the state a good deal more and the individual gets less because of the contingency fee?
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess looking at it from an appropriations risk management point of view, these folks that are in the prison, if they're there 20 years, it's unlikely that they arrived there without some activity from a county prosecutor all the way through. And it's been my experience that hopefully we don't have any folks like that in our prisons, but if they are, they have a civil rights action, and that civil rights, when I read about those cases across the nation, the damages paid are pretty significant. So with the Appropriations Committee amendment, the only the exchange for consideration is a waiver of your civil rights action, and those actions in other states are paying a lot more than we're compensated here. So the as it stands now, I don't know that it'll ever be utilized, because if a person finds that position, himself in that situation, they most likely would hire counsel, bring a civil rights action. But for that rare person who says, you know, I'd rather take my money and not hire a lawyer and just take my lump sum, it's a responsible way to provide that option. And it's going to be a lot less expensive than turning it loose. So we now have the provision that in order to receive the payment, you have to provide a full release to the state of Wyoming for all claims. And it saves a lot of litigation. A civil rights action, the attorney's fees itself would be $300,000. So it seems to me that it's a carrot out there. It's an alternative some people might want to take and not hire lawyers and go on with their life. If so, it's cost effective.
Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, my question was, can the state legally require this payment to be used or monitor? So, you know, I can see in these situations where a person could receive the $30,000 and spend it irresponsible and then come back to the state on different social programs that we have where we end up virtually paying twice. So I'm wondering if we can devise a program where we kind of supervise how the money is spent and for the benefit of the individual, or is it not legal?
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Let me tag on before the sponsor has to get up again. I wonder about this process of waiving your constitutional rights. We'll give you 30 grand. You sign this paper. Does that actually hold up? And you know, if suppose he takes the money and then goes to the and gets a lawyer and comes back and says, figures out that something was wrong with that deal. So is there risk in that? Thank you.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I voted for this bill in committee and through interim, and to me, I think the good chairman of JSC is exactly right. They don't necessarily have to take this thing. They can go get out, hire a lawyer, and spend the next 6 years in court, and any lawyer they get is probably going to be on a contingency, so that lawyer is going to take 40 or 50% or whatever they may get. Or they sit there and say, the state says, sorry about that, here's to compensate $30,000 and an annuity. An answer to my desk mate here, people can sign away, they sign away their, they waive their rights constantly in return for compensation. That's what a lot of settled lawsuits are all about. And in response to the chairman of revenue committee about getting on social programs and so forth, I believe that $30,000 figure, even if they don't make any other money, I think would make them ineligible for a number of the programs.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to remind that what it is the total amount is a maximum of $30,000. So, and it's amortized over $30,000 a year that comes out in 30,000. So if you have the maximum, you've got an annuity that's going to pay you $30,000 a year for it's going to be more than 10 years because it's going to be annuitized. But ultimately, that's the only effort that was made to control that money was to at least avoid having someone spend all $300,000 at once, that they can make a $30,000 mistake once a year for until it runs out. So.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 40, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The chair is in doubt. All those in favor, please rise. Opposed, please.
Seven.
House Bill 40 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 42. Reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 42, Coroner Record Confidentiality, an act relating to coroners, sponsored by Representative Gingery. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivisions, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Martin, and Scott, Senator Case, Chairman.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a do pass recommendation on House Bill 42, Coroner Record Confidentiality. Mr. Chairman, there is a Standing Committee Amendment. I'd ask that it be read in at this time.
House Bill 42, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 2, line 4.
Mr. Chairman, I would move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 42. Mr. Chairman. This is a bill about coroner records, and I think the best way to maybe explain this bill is to have folks that have the copy in your hand go to the very last page, which would be on page 8 before the enactment clause. And you can see here, this is the state of our existing law. And this is in the open the Public Records Act, Mr. Chairman, and it's what records are available. And if you look on lines 16 and 17, and I'm going to work with what the current state of the law is, Mr. Chairman, says the custodian shall deny the right of inspection of the following records unless otherwise provided by law. And one little I, Romanet 1, says medical, psychological, and sociological data on individual persons, of course, they are protected. And then it says exclusive of coroner's autopsy reports. That's the current law, Mr. Chairman. So the current law says that coroner's autopsy reports are public documents. That's basically what it says. And you should be able to get them. Now the question is, try to do that. Because around the state there are 23 different interpretations of what is public and what is not public in a death investigation. And that is the crux of the real problem that we have. And it's interpreted all sorts of different ways. Is it just an autopsy report? What is an autopsy report? We don't actually know sometimes. Sometimes the report is just a finding. Sometimes it's a huge, big bundle of things with audio recordings, with photographs, etc. And I'll tell you what. Basically, folks that hold this office don't necessarily want to release that information. They become very protective, and for good reasons, of the folks that, you know, the families and the victims, other people close to the thing, and they just don't really want to do it. And it makes it darn hard to get information. So this bill, although it's been kind of touted as restricting access, it actually, by clearing it up, improves access. So the rest of the bill, Mr. Chairman, is new language. It's all created language, and it tries to put some framework as to what should be released and under what circumstance. Now, Mr. Chairman, you weren't here last year when I brought another bill. I think I was the prime sponsor, and the other gentleman on this bill was the co-sponsor, and it went the other way. It made it all public records and said, get it out. And that didn't survive introduction in a budget session by two-thirds vote. So let's talk as we go through this bill. I'll be as brief as I possibly can, Mr. Chairman, but some of this is pretty important. So Section 1 of the bill, starting on page 1, this is new law created, 74105, confidentiality of reports. And here it is, starting on line 15. After viewing the body and completing his investigation, the coroner shall draw up and sign his verdict on the death under consideration. The coroner shall also make a written docket, giving an accurate description of the deceased person, his name if it can be determined, cause and manner of death. And I want to begin on a standing committee amendment as we go along, Mr. Chairman. So cause and manner of death, including relevant toxicological factors, comma, age of decedent, date and time of death, and a description of money and other property found on the body. The verdict and the written docket are public records and may be viewed or obtained by the request of the coroner pursuant to this statute. So they're public records, and that's a cross-reference to the Public Records Act. All right. The rest is to put a little bit of framework. There are some exceptions. Exceptions provided in subsection C, D, and E of this section, a toxic ecological report, a photograph, a video recording, or audio recording made at the scene of the death or made in the course of a postmortem examination or autopsy, may or caused by a coroner, shall be confidential and are not public records. Not public records. But there are some exceptions. And we'll get to those exceptions. And so, one of the exceptions is C. A surviving spouse, surviving parent, and an adult child, tracking in the amendment, personal representative or legal representative, or a legal guardian may... They get a look at anything. Little eyes, view a copy of the toxicology report, photographs, video recordings, anything they want. They can listen to any information. That's on the top of page 3. They get access to it all. Law enforcement and other people that have an interest in the death from a professional standpoint, health officers, occupational folks, you know, the list goes on here, have the ability to make a written request. And, Mr. Chairman, in the amendment tracks in there, we added on line 14 some other entities can make this written request, including the state occupational epidemiologist, the department, and the division responsible for administering the Wyoming Occupational Health and Safety Act, and the Office of the Inspector of Mines. They can, of course, on lines 21, view the toxicology report, photographs, or videos. They can look at the postmortem examination, et cetera. If you go on to page 4, they can listen to these audio recordings we've talked about. But there's a little bit of qualifications. On page 4, lines 7, 8, and 9, unless otherwise required in the performance of their official duties, they shall maintain anonymity of the deceased. I'm getting redundant. The identity of the deceased shall not be released. So that they could use the what happened in terms of an accident report or reconstruction or to try to improve worker safety or in a training procedure. And if it's not necessary to release the decedent's name, they don't have to. And that's the subject of lines 7 through 10, page 4, section E. As you can see, this is lines 10 through 15 on page 4. We struck the language about the records obtained under section D of this section may be used in a criminal action or civil proceeding before the Wyoming Board of Healthcare Licensing Boards. So we struck out that a licensing board could have access to this information. Little F on page 4, the coroner having custody of a toxicology report, a photograph, video made at the scene or made in the course of a postmortem examination or autopsy may allow the use for case consultation with an appropriate expert. So they can share it. They can get an expert to look at it. The coroner may also allow the use of the toxicological report or photograph or video recording, audio recording made at the scene of death or made in the course of a postmortem examination or autopsy by legitimate scientific research organizations for training purposes, provided the identity of the decedent is not published or otherwise made public. That's how you can use it for training. All right. The next part, G under page 5, is what you can go to the court to get the rest of this information. So a court, upon a showing of good cause, may issue an order authorizing a person to look at all the toxicological reports. I'm not going to be able to say that three more times, I guarantee you, Mr. Chairman. But all the reports that we've talked about previously, or listen to any other audio or video, and view the video recordings. So, needs good cause. What is good cause? That starts on page 19 and 20. In determining good cause under subsection G of this section, the court shall consider, Romanet 1, whether the disclosure is necessary for the public evaluation of governmental performance. Romanet 2, the seriousness of the intrusion into the family's privacy. Romanet 3, whether the disclosures of the toxicology report, photograph, video recording, or audio recording is by the least intrusive means available. And Romanet 5, the availability of similar information in other public records, regardless of form. All right. Whenever the court has a request, there is a notice given to the surviving spouse or whoever's in charge. And that's on page 6, I guess the next of kin is what we would call that, Mr. Chairman. Lines 11 through 21 says that when the court gets this request, these people get a copy of it, and they have the opportunity to be present and heard. And there is a little bit more about the Standing Committee Amendment on line 20. Once again, after the word legal guardian, we add the words personal representative or legal representative. And then beginning on the bottom of page 6, subsection K talks about the violations of this section by the coroner or his designee. That's a 6 months and $1,000. M is a little bit more about that. A person who knowingly or purposefully uses the information in a manner other than specified purpose for which it was released or violates a court order issued under subsection G of this section is guilty of the same misdemeanor, 6 months and $1,000. N, in all cases, the viewing, copying, listening to, or other handling of the toxicology report, photograph, video recording, or other audio recording made at the scene of the death or made in the course of the post-mortem examination or autopsy made or caused by a coroner shall be under the direct supervision of the coroner and the coroner's designee, who is the custodian of the record. So the coroner is kind of responsible for doing this. Line 21O, this is the case of a contagious disease where there's an emergency. The coroner's finding he's directed to supply the information to the appropriate health officer to deal with a public health emergency. That carries on to the top of page 8. And then we have section 2, which goes into the existing Public Records Act. And instead of saying that language I spoke about earlier about autopsy reports being the exclusive part, now the verdicts and written dockets, as provided by all the created statutes that we just talked about, will now be public. So, Mr. Chairman, that is the bill. We've tracked the Standing Committee Amendment through. The largest significant aspect of the Standing Committee Amendment is that in determining the manner and cause of death, the coroner is supposed to report on relevant toxicological factors. And that's, we've struggled with that because a lot of folks wanted the entire toxicological report published. And those things are very, very sophisticated now. They will tell basically what you had for breakfast and what you had for breakfast last week. They will say what medications you're on, which you may or may not feel is necessarily public information. And so the question is, should all that be released? Well, I think we all agree that if it has something to do with the manner and cause of death, it should be released. And that's what the Standing Committee Amendment puts forward. I'll give you an example. I don't know. You may be taking a particular drug that's advertised on national TV and causes great embarrassment when your kids come in the room. This is for you fellas in here, which there's almost all of us are. Is that necessary that information be published upon your death? Is that a good thing? Does that achieve anything? Only if it could be somehow relevant to your cause of death. And I'd have to think about that a little bit, Mr. Chairman, but I don't think in most cases that would be relevant. So, but if you were operating a motor vehicle,
and you had alcohol in your system, that's relevant. And, you know, so if there was a combination of drugs that caused this to happen, that's relevant. But some things are just not relevant. Answer any questions you got, Mr. Chairman.
All those in question has been called. All those in favor of Senator Case's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 42, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion to adopt the Standing Committee Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 42 has passed. We are back on the bill. Question has been called for. All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 42, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? House Bill 42 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next two looks like... Senator, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Ain't happening. Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. House Bill 23, do pass amended. House Bill 92, do pass amended. House Bill 120, do pass amended. House Bill 121, failed to pass Committee of the Whole and was indefinitely postponed. House Bill 167, do pass. House Bill 190, do pass. House Bill 202 do pass. House Bill 206 do pass. House Bill 211 do pass amended. House Bill 215 do pass amended. House Bill 223 do pass. House Bill 259 do pass. House Joint Resolution 1 do pass. House Bill 40 do pass amended. And House Bill 42 do pass amended. Senator Emmerich, Chairman.
Senator Emmerich.
The Committee of the Whole report.
Heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion is carried. The report has been adopted. Senators, I'd urge you to be patient. Keep your chairs. We have some housekeeping we need to do. We need to do this today. I'll make tomorrow a much better day. Messages from the House.
February the 24th. From the House of Representatives, message number 414, conferees appointed Joint Conference Committee number 1. Mr. President, the Speaker appointed House conferees to meet with a like committee number 1 from the Senate on amendments to House Bill 127. The House conferees are Representative Teeters, Chairman, Representative Harshman, and McKim. February the 24th, 2011, from the House of Representatives, message 415, conferees appointed, Joint Conference Committee number 1. Mr. President, the Speaker appointed House conferees to meet with the like committee number 1 from the Senate on amendments to Senate File 9. The House conferees are Representative Semlich, Chairman, Representative Throne, and Wallace. February the 24th, 2011, from the House of Representatives, message number 416, conferees appointed, Joint Conference Committee number 1. Mr. President, the Speaker appointed House conferees to meet with the like committee number 1 from the Senate on amendments to Senate File 146. The House conferees are Representative Teeters, Chairman, Representatives Miller and Stubson, Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Concurrences. Senator Nicholas, are you ready in regard to message number 410?
I am.
Okay. While you're looking, we'll go ahead and read that in.
February the 24th, 2011, from the House of Representatives, message number 410. Concurrence requested, Mr. President. Senate file 144, state-funded construction projects preference provision. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 54, noes 4, excused 2. House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments.
Go ahead, Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move concurrence message number 410 to Senate file 144 and ask that you vote aye. This is the state-funded construction bill for the contracting preferences for construction managers at risk. It only effective during the term of the current budget. All the amendments came from the Appropriations Committee on the House side that were, for the most part, co-sponsors of the bill. All of the amendments were what I would call cleanup in nature. They were all appropriate, and I urge you to support the changes.
Any discussion? Seeing none, the motion is that the Senate do concur on Senate file 144, and you've been asked to vote aye. Chief Clerk, please call a roll.
Barnard. Bebout,
aye.
Burns,
aye.
Case,
aye.
Christensen,
aye.
Coe,
aye.
Cooper,
aye.
Dockstader,
aye.
Driscoll,
aye.
Amrick,
aye.
Esquivel, Geis,
aye.
Hastert,
aye.
Hicks, Hines,
aye.
Jennings,
aye.
Johnson excused, Landon,
aye.
Martin,
aye.
Meyer, Nicholas,
aye.
Nutting, Perkins,
aye.
Peterson,
aye.
Ross,
aye.
Rothfuss,
aye.
Schiffer,
aye.
Scott,
aye.
Von Platern,
aye.
President Anderson,
aye.
Esquivel,
excused.
Hicks,
excused.
Nutting,
excused.
Closing vote, closing. Vote closed. 26 ayes, 4 excused.
By your vote, you have concurred on Senate file 144. Senator Case, are you ready in regard to message number 405? We'd like that read in at this time.
February the 24th, 2011, from the House of Representatives, message number 405, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate file 79. Recreation Safety Act waiver on behalf of minors. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 56, noes 2, excused 2. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments.
Go ahead, Senator Case.
Mr. President, thank you. I move message number 405 to Senate file 79, Recreation Safety Act waiver on behalf of minors, and I ask the Senate to concur. All that the other body did was to add another item to the list of things covered by the Recreation Safety Act. And remember, there's that list that says includes but is not limited to. And we had added snowboarding, and they wanted to one-up us, and they added and other alpine sports. I think it's getting pretty serious here, Mr. President, but I think we should go ahead and concur anyway.
Any discussion? Seeing none, the motion is that the Senate do concur on Senate File 79. You've been asked to vote aye. Chief Clerk, please call the roll.
Barnard.
Aye.
Bebout.
Aye.
Burns.
Aye.
Case.
Aye.
Christensen.
Aye.
Coe.
Aye.
Cooper.
Aye.
Dockstader.
Aye.
Driscoll.
Aye.
Amrick.
Aye.
Esquivel excused. Geis.
Aye.
Hastert. Hicks excused, Hines,
aye.
Jennings,
aye.
Johnson excused, Landon,
aye.
Martin,
aye.
Meyer,
aye.
Nicholas,
aye.
Nutting excused,
excuse.
Perkins,
aye.
Peterson,
aye.
Ross,
aye.
Rothfuss,
aye.
Schiffer,
aye.
Scott,
aye.
Von Platern,
aye.
President Anderson,
aye.
Closing vote, closing. Vote closed. 26 ayes, 4 excused.
By your vote, you have concurred on Senate File 79. Senator Burns, are you ready in regard to message number 406?
Yes, Mr. President, I am.
Would we read that in at this time, please?
February the 24th, 2011, from the House of Representatives, message number 406, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 85, Game and Fish Violations Penalties. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 47, noes 11, excused 2. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments.
Go ahead, Senator Burns.
Shot a couple of elk over here, and then you went somewhere else and shot, say, some bighorn sheep, then that would be considered as two different offenses. And, Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, I don't see that as fatal to the bill. You got bigger problems.
Any discussion? Seeing none, the motion is that the Senate do concur in regard to Senate File 85. You've been asked to vote aye.
You shouldn't have a gun.
Chief Clerk, please call the roll.
Barnard?
Aye.
Bebout?
No.
Burns?
Aye.
Case?
No.
Christensen?
Aye.
Coe?
No.
Cooper?
Aye.
Dockstader?
No.
Driscoll?
No.
Emmerich?
No.
Esquibel excused. Geis?
No.
Hastert?
Aye.
Hicks excused. Hines?
No.
Jennings?
No.
Johnson excused. Landon? Martin?
Aye.
Meyer?
No.
Nicholas?
No.
Nutting excused. Perkins?
Aye.
Peterson?
No.
Ross?
No.
Rothfuss?
No.
Schiffer?
Aye.
Scott?
No.
Von Flatern?
Aye.
President Anderson?
Aye.
Closing vote?
Cooper, aye
to no. Closing vote?
No.
Closing. Vote closed. 11 ayes, 15 noes, 4 excused.
By your vote, you have failed to concur on Senate File 85. Senator Burns, I'll get with you later in regard to a conference committee on that particular bill. Senator Burns, are you ready in regard to message 402?
Well, I'm not quite sure, Mr. President. Yes, I am, Mr. President.
Go ahead, read that in, please.
February 24th, 2011, from the House of Representatives, message number 402, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 33, State Parks Acquisition of Lands. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 44, noes 14, excused 2. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendment. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Go ahead, Senator.
Mr. President, I move message 402, being Senate File 33, State Parks Acquisition of Lands, and ask the body to vote aye. Mr. President, as you recall, this dealt with the acquisition of additional land that would be added on to Kirkcaldy State Park. And what the House did was stated that if they got the... They put two amendments in there. One is if they got the land and there was any money left over, that it would revert to the general fund, which is...
It's the general fund. Yeah.
Which is to make sense to me. And then the other amendment they put in was taking the money from the... Instead of the budget reserve account, taking it from the general fund, which makes... Okay. I don't know why they had to do it, but there really is no difference between the two. I was asked by one of the members whether any of this property involved state lands, involved school sections, in relation to a conversation that happened earlier on the floor today, and I checked, and one portion of the land, it's a contiguous piece of property, but in the legal description, one portion of the land is on a state, it's on a Section 16 parcel, which I believe is a state school section. I didn't check any further than that. And Mr. President, that may affect the way somebody may vote on this bill, but it shouldn't.
The motion, is there any discussion? The motion is that the Senate do concur on Senate File 33. You've been asked to vote aye. Chief Clerk, please call the roll.
Barnard. Bebout. Burns. Case. Christensen. Coe. Cooper. Dockstader. Driscoll. Emmerich. Escobel excused. Geis. Hastert. Hicks excused. Hines. Jennings,
no.
Johnson excused, Landon,
no.
Martin,
no.
Meyer,
aye.
Nicholas,
aye.
Nutting excused, Perkins,
aye.
Peterson,
aye.
Ross,
aye.
Rothfuss,
aye.
Schiffer,
aye.
Scott,
aye.
Von Flatern,
okay.
President Anderson.
Aye.
Closing vote. Landon, no to aye. Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. 16 ayes, 10 noes, 4 excused.
By your vote, you have concurred on Senate File 33. Signing of enrolled acts. Senate Enrolled Act Number 54.
Senate Enrolled Act 54 being original Senate File 10.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 54, original Senate File 10. Have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act Number 55.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 55, being original Senate File 55.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 55, original Senate File 55. Have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 56.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 56, being original Senate File 119.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act Number 56, original Senate File 119. I've so signed. Senate Enrolled Act Number 57.
Senate Enrolled Act being original Senate File 128.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 57, original Senate File 128. Have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act Number 58.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 58 being original Senate File 73.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 58, original Senate File 73. Have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 59.
Senate Enrolled Act 59 being original Senate File 45.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 59, original Senate File 45. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act Number 60.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 60 being original Senate File 134.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 60, original Senate File 134. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 61.
Senate Enrolled Act 61 being original Senate File 138.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act Number 61, original Senate File 138. Have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 62.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 62, being original Senate File 147.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 62, original Senate File 147. So signed. Senate Enrolled Act 63.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 63, being original Senate File 101.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act Number 63, original Senate File 101. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 64.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 64, being original Senate File 72.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act Number 64, original Senate File 72. I have so signed. House Enrolled Act Number 48.
House Enrolled Act Number 48, being original House Bill 73.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act 48, original House Bill 73. I have so signed. House Enrolled Act Number 49.
House Enrolled Act Number 49, being original House Bill 36.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act 49, original House Bill Number 36. And so signed. House Enrolled Act Number 50.
House Enrolled Act Number 50, being original House Bill 135.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act Number 50, original House Bill 135. Have so signed. House Enrolled Act Number 52.
House Enrolled Act Number 52, being original House Bill 139.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act Number 52, original House Bill Number 139. Have so signed. House Enrolled Act 53.
House Enrolled Act Number 53, being original House Bill 151.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act Number 53, original House Bill Number 151. I'm sorry. I need to sign that. And I have so signed. Need to do this one again. Original, this is House Enrolled Act Number 51. We'll do that one again.
House Enrolled Act Number 51, being original House Bill 136.
I'm about to sign Enrolled Act Number 51, House Bill, original House Bill 136. House Enrolled Act Number 54.
House Enrolled Act Number 54, being original House Bill 193.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act 54, original House Bill 193. I'm so signed. House Enrolled Act Number 55.
House Enrolled Act Number 55, being original House Bill 203.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act Number 55, original House Bill 203. Have so signed. House Enrolled Act 56.
House Enrolled Act Number 56, being original House Bill 242.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act Number 56, original House Bill 242. I have so signed. House Enrolled Act Number 57.
House Enrolled Act Number 57 being original House Bill 248.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act 57, original House Bill 248. I have so signed. House Enrolled Act 58.
House Enrolled Act Number 58 being original House Bill 217.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act 58, original House Bill 217. I have so signed. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Yowza. Before I make the appropriate motion, Mr. President, reminder that tomorrow morning is the governor's prayer breakfast at 7 a.m. We're going to gavel in tomorrow morning early, and we'll hear the concurrence on the budget. You'll see 15 bills up on general file tomorrow. Try to move through that as expeditiously as we can. And with that, Mr. President, I move that the Senate stand adjourned until 9:30 a.m. February 25th.
Thank you, Senator Geis. Go ahead.
Your committee number 5 will have a joint conference, well, not the committee, but your conference-appointed committee on Message 348 will meet upon adjournment. And then right after that, we're going to hear a conference call with Jeanette Skeen, and we'll interview Pat Terrell.
Senator Bebow.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, will meet over in the House in their committee room on adjournment to discuss interim work.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. Confirmation hearing on the appointment of Tom Forslund to be Director, Department of Health. And then, Mr. President, at noon, we'll meet with our counterparts in the House and the House committee room on joint interim work.
Senator Coe.
Hey, Mr. President, your committee number 4 will meet in the morning over here, and I just want to remind everybody I had it scheduled for 8 to do confirmation hearings. I'm going to change that to 8:30 for members of the Education Committee because of the Governor's Prayer Breakfast. And then one other announcement. The Conference Committee on House Bill 13, that being Senator Barnard and Rothfuss, will meet tomorrow on adjournment over in House Education.
Senator Perkin.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 1, Judiciary, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock in room S1. We have at 8 o'clock the confirmation hearing for the new director, proposed director for Department of Family Services, Mr. Steve Corsi. Then we'll have a visit with, at 8:30, we'll have a visit with Edward Wright, who is a potential appointee or prospective appointee to the Board of Parole. And then we'll finish up with a confirmation hearing for the nominated Attorney General, Greg Phillips, at 9 o'clock in room S1. Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator Hine.
Mr. President, the Revenue Committee will meet tomorrow at 8 a.m. for confirmation hearings on the Board of Equalization Director. And at 8:20 for, that is Paul Gause. And at 8:20, we'll entertain confirmation hearing for the Department of Revenue, Ed Smith.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. President, your Transportation Committee will meet 10 minutes after noon adjournment over in the House Transportation Committee room to talk about interim topics.
Senator Coe.
Yeah, Mr. President, I forgot to tell the committee number 4. We're going to meet tomorrow at noon over in House Education to talk interim topics for members of the House, of the Senate Education Committee.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. President, the Senate Appropriations Committee is going to meet tomorrow at 8:15 in the morning to do confirmation hearings on the Retirement System Board. We're going to have 3 telephonic hearings, and then at 9 a.m. to consider the appointment to the Director of Administration and Information. And the Senate Appropriations Committee then will meet with our counterparts in the House on Monday at 1 p.m. to do our final topics for interim study. And finally, Mr. President, the conference committee, which includes myself, Senator Jennings, and Esquivel, will be meeting Monday morning at 9 a.m. to do the conference report on Senate File 146. That's the Accountability Act.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 7 will meet at 7:45 a.m. to have a telephone conference with the governor's appointee to the state fire marshal's office. That's Lanny Applegate. He's a reappointment. And we'll get done very quickly because most of the committee has to move over to revenue after that.
Other announcements? Seeing none, the motion, earlier motion, was that the Senate stand adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning, February 25th. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion has carried. We do stand adjourned until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow, February 25th. We are adjourned.